Are we ready, King? Okay. I'm going to call this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission of Thursday, June 24th, to order. Roll call, please, Ramona.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Here.
Commissioner Melska?
Here.
Commissioner White?
Here.
Chairperson Christensen?
Here.
Please let the record show Commissioner Wyatt is absent.
He's on vacation, lucky her. Okay, next we are going to have a song and then the flag salute. And our singer this morning is Delilah Schenck. She is a singer and actor, currently in Kelvick Productions Cabaret as Fräulein Schneider. She specializes in songs by Edith Piaf. Lives in Morro Bay, and she is singing for us God Bless America. And directly after that, we will have our flag salute. So please stand.
God bless America, land that I love.
Okay, and thanks again to Delilah Schenck, the local singer and actor. And if anybody else would like to come and provide us with a little song in the mornings, the beginning of our Planning Commission meetings, please contact Jill at ymisa@charter.net. Ymisa is WIMISA@charter.net. Talk to Jill. And thank you very much again. All right. Now it's time for public comment for items not on the agenda. I don't see any speaker slips. Do I have anybody here for public comment on items not on the agenda? Seeing none, we will go straight to planning staff updates. Warren?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Warren Ho, Department of Planning and Building. I'm just going to talk about your summer schedule. Seems like it's been a constant theme recently because it's a bit unorthodox this year. We have a meeting scheduled for July 1st, which is just a week from today. But depending on the outcome of your first hearing item on the agenda regarding the housing ordinance amendments, if that's completed, then we won't need to have the meeting. If it's not completed, we will have the meeting. And I'm sure Mr. Stevenson and staff can talk more about options as you get deeper into that item. Then the next Planning Commission meeting is on July 29th. Due to scheduling conflicts, we couldn't get the board chambers on our regular second and fourth Thursdays in July. So we have the first, which we may not have, and we have July 29th, which we will have. Then we are not having our first meeting of the month in August because the Coastal Commission will be in the board chambers that week. So you will have a meeting on August 26th, and there is a agenda full of items for that. And then in September, you're back to the regular second and fourth Thursdays. For your meetings, and then in November and December things get awkward again because of the holidays, and we'll talk more about that as we get closer. But I just want to give you a heads up through the summer so you can plan your own calendars. So that's the only thing that I had, unless your commission has any quick questions or Mr. Stevens has anything for staff updates. That's it.
Commissioner Grady, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Hogue, often have to make plans many, many months in advance these days, and we have a family deal going out of town around the Christmas holidays, and I wondered how soon you might know what the December schedule would be so that I could, if at all possible, try to arrange my personal affairs around the commission meetings.
At this point, it looks like we will only have one meeting in December, and it will be December 9th, which is the second Thursday. We typically don't have the second meeting of the month because it's right there in the middle of the holidays.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hogue. We're now moving on to our consent agenda. We have minutes from April 22nd and minutes from May 13th. Do I have any edits, changes, motion, anything?
Make a motion we approve consent agenda.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Those minutes are approved for most things. Okay, now we're moving into our public hearings for the day. And let's see, I think, Ramona, I'm supposed to ask you to introduce it.
Hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend Titles 22 and 23 of the County Code, the Land Use and Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinances, and the Land Use Element Local Coastal Plan Part 1, Coastal Framework for Planning, to incorporate emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing per state law. County file number LRP 2009-0002, all supervisorial districts. Chuck Stevenson to introduce.
Thank you,
Ramona. Before I have Chuck start, I just wanted to ask the commission briefly if there were any ex partes on this item. I don't think so, but
I made a call to staff yesterday to Morgan just to ask if she could bring the housing element that's referenced in the staff report.
Okay, good. All right, Mr. Stevenson.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Christensen, members of the commission. Chuck Stevenson, planning staff. Before I begin, I just want to mention that we do have extra copies of the documents that you'll be reviewing today. They're over to my left down here for anybody in the public who wants to see those. And Dana Lilly and Morgan Terrell will be making the presentation this morning. With them is Jeff Oliveira from our Environmental Division
and Alternate Practices. Nevertheless, this amendment will make it clear how we are complying. I also want to make one brief comment about emergency shelters or homeless shelters, whatever you want to call them. The likelihood that a nonprofit or other entity will propose a new emergency shelter in county jurisdiction is extremely unlikely. Currently, we have the primary homeless shelter here in the city of San Luis. That's the Maxine Lewis Memorial Homeless Shelter. There's a homeless shelter in Atascadero operated by the nonprofit ECHO. And that's all of the homeless shelters in the county. And I can tell you, because we are also a funding agency that provides funds to them, there aren't enough public and private funds to keep those programs fully funded and operating. And we know that there's a group in the Five Cities area, which initially they're proposing a homeless service center, but they would really like it to include a 24-hour shelter if they could afford it. So what I'm trying to describe for you is we really aren't likely to see any homeless shelters proposed in our towns. It is possible. It's just very unlikely. And with that, I'll turn it over to Morgan.
Good morning, Chairperson Christensen and members of the commission. Morgan Terrell, planning staff. This is a hearing to consider a request to amend Title 22, Title 23, and the Land Use Element Local Coastal Plan, Part 1, Coastal Zone Work for Planning, to incorporate emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing. As Dana mentioned, in 2007, Senate Bill 2 amended Government Code Sections 65582, 65583, and 65589.5, basically to remove barriers to constructing or siting emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing. And more specifically, for the emergency shelter portion of the law, local government must identify a zone or zones where emergency shelters are allowed without a discretionary permit to accommodate the need, to accommodate the need of emergency shelters identified in the housing element. And what that was basically based on the homeless enumeration count in 2009 that was completed. It was based on account of people actually viewing people in the community that are homeless and then school children, and the estimated amount for the unincorporated county was 675 people at that time. It's about 17% of the total share. You can see what the other jurisdictions' shares are too, approximately. Some of them may have estimated a little bit differently, but the city of San Luis Obispo is roughly double what our share is, and you can see the other jurisdictions there. The The law also requires local governments to treat transitional housing and supportive housing as a residential use of property, only subject to the restrictions that apply to other dwellings in the same zone, which means basically if a multifamily project required a specific type of use permit and setbacks, open space requirements, other restrictions, the same exact standards would apply to a multifamily housing project that was supportive housing or transitional housing. What is emergency shelter? Per the state law, they're referred to health and safety code definitions. And an emergency shelter is housing with minimal supportive services for homeless persons. Occupancy is 6 months or less, typically. And the county is also proposing to permit any kind of day shelter if there's an application for a day shelter homeless facility to include that also as emergency shelter. And the law also states that emergency shelters can only be subject to standards that apply to residential or commercial development within the same zones chosen, except for we can allow or provide written objective development standards. And those are noted in the law. There's 8 of them. You can see here it's maximum number of beds, parking, size and location of waiting and intake areas, on-site management, proximity to other shelters, length of stay, lighting, and security. They do have some kind of requirements with those. That, for example, parking, you can't require more than other residential and commercial uses within the zone chosen. And proximity to other shelters, you can't require that they be more than 300 feet away from another shelter, but you can require up to 300 feet. And transitional housing, according to the Health and Safety Code, are basically residential units configured as rental housing. It's operated under program requirements where there's a termination of assistance and recirculation to a new client, which means you, a minimum of 6 months, the clients have to be allowed to occupy that residence. Last year in August, program HE3.A commits the county to revising the general plan and ordinance to comply with state law. That's what we're doing right now. We said we would complete that in 2010, and I'll explain a timeline in a little bit more detail at the end. And the county, during the environmental review process, the county sent referrals to all the community services districts, the advisory councils, and many other agencies and departments. We also communicated with the shelter providers, like the women's shelters and Community Action Partnership and ECHO, a few others, and also Housing Developer, People Self-Help Housing, and staff also consulted several times with Community Action Partnership, who are the major provider of emergency services in the county. They operate the Maxine Lewis Shelter in San Luis Obispo to kind of understand their client needs. And so now, that was kind of just the background. Now I'll explain what the actual proposal is. For emergency, I'll start with emergency shelters. In the inland areas only, inland and coastal are a little bit different. The proposal, in the inland areas, staff proposes that they be allowed in 3 land use categories only, public facility, commercial service, and industrial, and only in the urban and village reserve lines, not in the rural areas. And that's because services such as bus lines or medical services, for example, are usually in the urban areas where they can access them. So we thought that that made the most sense instead of being sited far out in the rural areas. And then in some circumstances, I'll go into this, that there would only be a discretionary permit required, and in other circumstances, it would just be ministerial or no discretionary permit, which is required by the law to have some, at least one zone or one area where a ministerial permit is required. So the instances where there would be no discretionary permit or a ministerial permit would be when there's community water and sewer. Again, you're within those 3 zones I just discussed. You're in the urban and village reserve areas only, which, and then you're not in all of these restrictions listed here. For example, you're not on a historic site, you're not in the airport review area, you're not in a sensitive resource area, and so on. So there's a list here trying to be cognizant of these could cause impact if they were in these kind of areas. So we're not, we would not allow a ministerial permit in these instances. So basically what we're saying is that when a ministerial permit would be allowed would be if there's not community water and sewer available and one of these conditions exist, then that would require them to get a minor use permit. And the coastal areas, which is Title 23 in the land use element and ordinance amendments, the proposal is that all permits are discretionary. Again, they're only allowed in the three land use categories listed here: public facility, commercial service, and industrial, and they also must be in urban areas.
Morgan, if I could stop you right here, why the differential?
We consulted with in-house staff that deal with Coastal Commission quite a bit, and the primary reason is that we're pretty sure that Coastal Commission wouldn't approve this ever or allow it, and we have to comply.
Well, if law requires that these are done without a discretionary permit, and Coastal requires a discretionary permit, why couldn't we require a discretionary permit throughout the county?
We could propose that. It's just that Coastal Commission may not approve it.
I'm asking the opposite. Why can't we propose discretionary permits required throughout the county if it's required in the coastal?
Mr. Chair, or Ms. Chair, I can maybe weigh in on that. I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. The part of the statute that we're attempting to address with this proposed amendment is 65583 subdivision A1, or actually A4A. And what it says is that we have to identify a zone or zones within the county where emergency shelters can be allowed without a discretionary permit. So it doesn't specifically require that they necessarily be in or outside of the coastal zone. Our obligation is to identify a zone or zones where these things can be located without a discretionary permit.
Understand. That's one of my other questions. We didn't receive those codes in our staff report, and it would have been good to be able to read those. So maybe if we continue this on, we can get copies of those.
Of the Senate Bill 2, is that?
Yes, and all the referenced requirements and mandates.
Yeah, and sorry, I have some copies here that I just brought if you want to look at them right now, too. Well, during our hearing,
we're kind of shooting.
How many parking spaces do they need and things like that. So I spoke quite a bit with the Homeless Services Director there in order to get this information, and I spoke with city staff. And so that's how these were created. And parking, we can't require more than residential or commercial uses within the zones chosen. So there's some flexibility in these, but it just can't be more than what's required. And right now, the proposal, after doing that research and meeting with Community Action Partnership, was one space per six beds, plus one per staff and volunteer that's present, plus one per 10 beds for service vehicles. And service vehicles would be, for example, community health centers, might be a Department of Social Services worker or someone bringing food to the shelter, things like that. And so just so you get kind of a perspective, for a 30-bed facility, that would be five spaces for clients, three for service vehicles, and then however many staff and volunteers are. It might be three or five or something like that. So it might be between, 11 to 15 or so, just to get an idea there. And then the proposal is to limit any shelter to 100 persons or less, have a minimum of 7% of the square footage for indoor waiting areas. So, for example, a 3,000-square-foot facility would require 210 square feet for, a client intake waiting area. And then management, we would require one on-site manager or supervisor, basically someone managing the facility, for shelters up to 50 persons, and two managers for shelters with 51 to 100 persons. This does not include any kind of staff or volunteers. This is purely just management of the facility. So there would be additional staff there too. And then the last four, the law states that you can't require shelters to be more than 300 feet from another shelter. We chose to require the maximum, basically that no shelter be within 300 feet radius from another shelter. That occupancy be limited to 6 months or less. However, there could be an extension. Staff proposed that there's an extension because after talking with Community Action Partnership in a lot of detail about this issue is that some clients are doing really well. They're progressing on their case management plan to independence, but at the end of 6 months, for some reason, they weren't able to obtain affordable housing in our county, which is difficult, and so they suggested that there be some kind of relief for some clients because they would basically just fall back probably if they went into homelessness instead of progressing forward. And then lighting would be per current ordinance standards, nothing specific and different for this use. And then security, that there be at least 2 security cameras for every shelter. And for shelters with more than 50 or more clients, there'd be 1 security guard. So that was all focusing just on emergency shelters. And transitional and supportive housing are sort of a separate part of the law and a separate issue now that we'll go into. And transitional housing and supportive housing, again, must be treated the same way as single-family and multifamily dwellings within the same zone, or basically residential uses within the same zone. So they would be treated the same way as any other single-family or multifamily development that's within that zone.
Morgan, one question on that. So the difference between the emergency shelter and the transitional and the supportive housing is they're across the board. We're not looking to create just a specific zone where they can go without a discretionary.
Yeah, plan. That's right. So emergency shelters, basically, we can require that allow them in just specific zones. But the transitional and supportive housing, we're not creating any kind of different zone or anything like that. We're just allowing them exactly where single family and multifamily dwellings are allowed. Yeah.
Thank you.
There are a few minor changes. 2 basically minor changes that staff suggest. One is that it's staff's intent in both the coastal and inland areas to only allow emergency shelters in the urban and village reserve lines. We wanted to make sure that that was very clear in the first exhibit A, or exhibit LRP 2009-0002A, under A permit requirement number 1. We want to add a second sentence that says emergency shelters are not allowed outside of urban and village reserve lines. So it could be interpreted otherwise if that wasn't in there. So we'd like to add that sentence. And also in section 3 of exhibits LRP 2009-0002A and B, under F, length of stay, I just wanted to make shelter singular instead of plural. It's just a typo, so that was pretty minor. And then the time frame, I just wanted to touch one more time on that. So state law, in the state law, it requires adoption.
Movement on this item. So I don't see any little things on my, there we go. Commissioner, this is a countywide thing, so no, there's no particular district that's handling it. So why don't we go ahead, Commissioner O'Grady.
Thank you. Kind of hard to know where to start, but maybe the big picture first. These revisions proposed to the ordinances have been triggered by the Senate Bill 2. And in doing some research on the law, I came across a summary sheet prepared by the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, located in Sacramento, California. And I guess before going into some of the details of what that summary says, just my overall conclusion is that the law offers more options than what is being currently presented to the Planning Commission on the staff report. And as a preliminary conclusion, I would like to see staff develop all of the options that are allowed by the law, along with the implications of implementing those options, so that the commission can rationally pick and choose what might be best for the community, and I just don't think we have that right now. And maybe I could go through this summary and maybe illustrate some of those. I mean, a couple come to mind already. I mean, from a staff presentation, one was zone or zones. So, for example, shelters, there are three land use categories currently identified by staff for shelters. One, as I understand the law, would suffice, as would two. So I need to understand why that's not a possibility. In the bigger picture, the thrust of the Senate bill, as I get it, is for jurisdictions to take a more active role in planning for taking good care of our homeless and challenged population, which presumably, because there's this law, the state doesn't think we've all done that good a job in the past. And so the way I see this, planning is the key, and that means to me identifying specific areas in our far-flung county to where these portions of the populations need to be taken care of, and then the land or the sites or the locations identified that would correspond to that and best take care of those populations, and then ordinances written that would put those locations into law so that the public, all segments, all stakeholders of the public know going forward what the county's plans for that is. And as I read this California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, that is a valid approach to the law. Another thing that the summary says is that jurisdictions can cooperate and work together and recognize and codify that, for example, there was an article in the paper this morning, I forget where I stapled it, oh yes, apparently there's a strategy called A Path to a Home, a 10-year plan to end homelessness, which was endorsed by the county and the county's seven incorporated cities in 2009. I don't know what all that says or what the consequences are, but just on the surface, I mean, it sounds like that responds to this law, and that this planned shelter to be located adjacent to the Department of Social Services on Higuera might serve as a at least a partially adequate response to the law. Commission doesn't know that because that wasn't mentioned in the staff report. So I would like some discussion about that alternative. Let's see.
Countywide, we are trying to basically open it up to a few land use categories to make it more feasible, because it's pretty restrictive just with one zone. But yes, according to the law, one zone is required minimum, so it can be one or more.
It might be more productive if I could then comment on your response, and we deal with that item. Okay. So if maximizing opportunities is, as I understood your response, is a goal, well then, why not, before you cement into an ordinance, why not actually go out and identify areas and zone one, two, three specific sites that match where the needs are, rather than leave it indeterminate and open to the vagaries of the future?
I'll try to touch on that one. We did go through a process of identifying sites, and they comprise, about over 250 acres, was it? So and they happen to be in three different zones. What we don't know is which of, if any of these sites will be the most suitable to someone potentially proposing. We also don't know which might even be ever available, you know, for sale to be used. So as Morgan said, we were trying to stick with the spirit of the law, trying to reduce impediments to this type of facility being developed. We staff does believe that if the commission wanted to and the board agreed to reduce it to one or two of these zones, we would probably still have enough to comply with the law.
That's correct. Martin's
nodding, so I think that's a yes. So that is an option, but we are recommending to you that it be all three of the zones.
Dan, would I be able to interject here real quick?
Certainly.
Thank you very much. If we're trying to comply with law, but we also want discretion, it appears to me we could comply by minimizing the zones, and then the others could always come under a discretionary permit.
Well, the way we've constructed the proposed ordinance, they wouldn't be allowed in the other zones if you strike them out now. And then it would be just the one zone.
Well, could we structure the ordinance where they could be applied for in other zones under a discretionary permit?
We could revise the ordinance such that there's only one zone where a ministerial permit to shelter can happen, and if you want to go through discretionary, it could be in these other zones. It would take some level of staff work. Whether we would complete that all and be back to you in time to get to the board and comply with state deadline, I don't know.
Is that hard and fast, or is there flexibility in that compliance time frame?
Well, Tim may or may not want to chime in here. I'll give you my 2 cents worth. After a year passes since the housing element was last amended, if we haven't adopted this, we're technically out of compliance. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that we are no longer eligible for state funds. It does mean that we begin to be exposed to some level of legal liability. So if someone felt that they were grieved because they wanted to propose a use, and we still haven't changed our ordinances to make it clear it's allowed, they could bring some form of litigation. I think that's the primary reason.
Sorry to interrupt, Dan. I'll let you continue on.
Madam Chair, if I can... Hi.
Well, let me speak here. Since we're in the commission thing. I kind of am a little bit alarmed by listening to these questions from Commissioner O'Grady, because the way I understand it, the point is to allow the maximum discretion within reasonable guidelines. And what I hear you guys talking about is trying to limit the ability for someone to assume they're going to be able to do a shelter and, you know, to one zone, and then if they want to do something someplace else, they have to go through a major and expensive procedure. And these things are expensive. And we're talking about homeless and emergency shelters, which... we're not talking about people with a lot of money or organizations with a lot of money. So it seems to me that, yes, it's certainly legitimate to talk to the staff about how they came up with these three zones, but my understanding is that why they came up with them and how they came up with them is that after extensive research and looking at all the possibilities, these are the places where this county could feel most comfortable in allowing emergency shelters to go without, you know, huge amounts of permitting hearings required. And that's what we want. If you're talking about really addressing and enabling us to help our homeless, that's what we want to do, is reduce the amount of hoops they have to jump through. Now, we also heard Mr. Lilly say that the likelihood of actually having one of these things come up forward in the county is pretty dang nil, because the homeless are pretty much in the urban and village.
We felt the best way to go about this was to try and find those sites where these would be compatible uses. It's one of the reasons we didn't choose commercial retail, for example, because typically commercial retail is found in your downtown urban cores. We did choose our commercial service and industrial categories as those that made the most sense, perhaps had large vacant land still available instead of small lots that you would typically find in a downtown. And we did try and say where you're in an urban reserve line and you have water and sewer services available and you're outside of all these hazard areas, that's when no permit would be required. That would be the ministerial level permit. If any of those other things exist, any of those hazard areas, for instance, that jumps the permit level up to a discretionary permit in these various zones. So a lot of thought was put into determining what would be the broadest area to allow these types of uses, exactly as Vice Chair Christensen mentioned.
Commissioner Noska?
I have one quick question. You state that the emergency shelters must be 300 feet apart as a minimum. Could emergency, transitional, and supportive be provided all in one site?
Sort of like a campus?
Probably not, unless, because the transitional supportive housing are typically going to be multifamily dwellings, like apartments, or single-family dwellings, which are not allowed in the commercial service, industrial categories, or public facilities. So probably not.
That's right. They're not allowed currently. Yeah.
Okay. I just wasn't. Yeah, okay.
And if, with this chair's permission, if staff could respond to one of the questions that Commissioner O'Grady had about the shelter proposed in the city of San Luis Obispo. Currently, and this City Planning Commission approved last night a land use permit for a maximum shelter there of 200 beds. You can already tell by that number, that's not all of the homeless, even in San Luis Obispo City's share. So under this law, we couldn't enter into a written agreement with the city saying we've met our obligation through this partnership with the city. We are in a partnership with the city. We help fund it, and we're providing, the county's providing the land. But it's not to the level that would get us off the hook under SB2.
And my understanding of, after attending basically guidance workshops on this last year, was that in order, like, you can basically partner with another jurisdiction, but you have to do a formal multi-jurisdictional agreement, and you're required to actually construct a shelter within 2 years, not just plan for it and fund it, but actually construct a shelter. And we don't have a formal multi-jurisdictional agreement. We met with the cities to talk about it, and all the jurisdictions basically said they didn't want to do it because we were afraid that we wouldn't be able to meet that obligation of actually constructing a shelter within 2 years. And then, so basically that 200-bed shelter, as I understand it, would assist the city and possibly reduce the amount that they have to plan for. But I understand they're in hearings right now already. They've been through Planning Commission on their ordinance amendments, and they're going to the City Council in July. But I don't think that would reduce our unmet need, basically.
Commissioner Grady? Grady, you want to continue?
Yes, thank you. I would like to respond to Commissioner Christensen's concerns, or alarm, as she put it. I believe the homeless and other challenged populations exist in the community, as do all the rest of us. They're part of our community, and to carve out and set up these targeted requirements at the expense of community dialogue and discretion, I think is the wrong approach. And in fact, I think it flies in the face of the underlying philosophy that our community has in these ordinances. And one of the primary ones is the orderly development of our community. And to me, the changes proposed to this ordinance do not enhance orderly development of our community, because I think there are other ways to go about it that solicit input from the communities where shelters are needed and transitional and supportive housing is needed. So as I'm trying to understand our ordinances and our general plan and what it means and reflect those values.
Conflicts here with the transitional and supportive housing just across the board in residential areas, I think, will be flooded with complaints. And so I did come here prepared to ask the same thing, what alternatives we have and what other, how we can accomplish this in a different way that will be more accepted out in the community. So starting with that, then I have a few clarification questions. One is, I don't have a clear definition of transitional housing, what that is, and how that could be used as an emergency shelter or homeless shelter in residential neighborhoods. Is there a minimum size for emergency shelters? In other words, could a transitional house be used as an emergency shelter?
In response to that, transitional housing and supportive housing are totally separate facilities than emergency shelters, so they should be thought of as completely separate. We're not proposing a minimum size of emergency shelters at this time. And transitional housing, I can go to our definition here. It's,
what page are we on, Morgan?
Let me get to it.
Madam Chair, I can chime in a little bit just while they're getting ready. The statute actually describes definitions for transitional and supportive housing. Unfortunately, it's done by way of a reference to the Health and Safety Code. I brought the government code down, but I didn't bring the Health and Safety Code. If we need it, we can go upstairs and bring it down as well.
Yeah, and if you go to page 1-7 of your original staff report, there's the definitions of the three uses there. And transitional housing are basically dwelling units, residential, multifamily, or single family units that are rental housing developments, and they're operated under some sort of program requirements to basically require the clients at some point in time to move on to some other housing type. So an example is Transitions Mental Health Association. They have units where they operate. People live there between 6 months and 2 years, depending on how they're doing. And then after 2 years, they're required to move on to some sort of other housing, and then a new client moves on. And that's required by our supportive housing program grant to do this. So whereas supportive housing is permanent, it's considered permanent. So a client could live there for however long they want to live there, basically. And that's sort of the difference there. And basically, like, transitional housing and supportive housing should definitely not be mixed with emergency shelters, because they're different requirements in the law. In transitional and supportive housing, basically the law says just treat them the same way as other residential uses. So we're not proposing any kind of new standards for those. I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Yeah, I just want to chime in. I don't think we have a whole lot of discretion in terms of the new language on the transitional and supportive. I think that's, we got to treat them the way the other, you know, multifamily and residential requirements, that we can't really change that stuff. It's the emergency shelter stuff that we've got more discretion on.
That's correct.
So I hear your concern is more about what people could go into transitional and supportive housing because it's in residential areas, but that's not where we have the discretion today.
Well, I understand that. The way I see it, we're being asked to make a recommendation to the board. And I would like to get staff's response to my comments about how on a regular basis when we approve projects, we make those findings. And where I can't see how I could make this finding, and since we're just making a recommendation to the board, it's up to the board to comply with the law or not, irregardless of what the state tells us we have to do. I can't in good conscience make a recommendation that I can't make that finding. So I would like to get staff's response to that.
Can, for point of clarification, Commissioner White, are you asking about transitional and supportive housing?
I am, in the residential areas, yes.
Because, again, under the law and in our proposed package to you, we're not proposing to change whether you can get ministerial or discretionary permit for an apartment complex or a single-family home. Those standards are on the books now. They won't change. So if someone comes to us, wants to build a 5-unit apartment complex, and they have some federal funding and they're going to operate it as supportive housing, it's just an apartment complex to us. And that's how we would have treated it under existing ordinances. And, yes, there would be findings for approval, just like there are now. So that's not really a change. It's just clarifying in our ordinances how we are in fact in compliance with the new law. The only ministerial piece of this is for homeless shelters. I don't know if that helped, but
just for a point of clarification, so I'm thinking existing residences. So today, if someone wanted to go in and set up a transitional house or supportive housing in an existing neighborhood, would they be required to get any kind of use permit to do so?
No.
When they say recirculation of the assisted unit to another eligible program recipient, basically, like, because most of the transitional housing is funded with some sort of grant.
When you transition one person out and another
exactly.
one into the unit.
Yes.
Okay, I got it. That makes sense then. I just was... another program. Okay, then it does make sense under that context. All right, then I'm going to get rid of my notes to strike and change and all that stuff. Okay, let me start at the beginning of my questions then here.
And if, as you're starting, if we can make one point, these two, we did anguish over these definitions before we put them in the proposed ordinance for you, and we did end up concluding to go ahead and use the health and safety code definitions, even though they're not the most clearly worded that I could have imagined, but it makes it clear how our ordinances relate to state law, at least, so we went ahead and included them.
So you didn't feel a need to get more definitive on the definitions, for example, of transitional housing, because it's allowed currently
in
all of our residential neighborhoods. Okay. Let's see what I got here. Page 1... On page 1-2, where we talk about the 8 standards that apply to emergency shelters, they apply only to emergency shelters then, not to transitional.
Correct.
Okay. Page 1-4, the North Coast Advisory Group had their concerns because there's no limitation on the number of people allowed in the transitional or supportive housing. Do we have any current ordinances that limit the number of people that live in a single-family residence or a...
No, and the reason why there's no maximum there is because there's no maximum for related persons right now, and it's you can't discriminate between people that are related and unrelated living in a dwelling.
So there's no health and safety code about, two people per bedroom, something to that effect?
No, there is a housing code. It's in the Uniform Building Code that does limit how many square footage, square feet you need per person. Do you recall what that is?
I think it's about 110 square feet per person is what...
And it's strictly by square footage, not bedrooms or baths? It's
yeah, that, from what I understand, that's true.
So theoretically, somebody could go out and build a one-bedroom, one-bath, 6,000-square-foot home and house however many people that would fit in that calculation.
Yeah, and it depends. We have to be careful, too, because there is still a definition of residential care facilities. Some of them would fit, if it's a facility and not dwelling units, then that's really residential care, and then they have to follow the permits required for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, I can just add for Commissioner White's benefit. I'm sure you probably know this, Bruce, but it's virtually impossible to for a local government to regulate the number of unrelated people that live in a single-family dwelling.
Yes. I just thought, people are crowding in 20 people in a two-bedroom home, but it sounds like the square footage would apply at that point.
And I wouldn't rely on that.
Yeah, and as a practical matter, it's a bigger issue. There's overcrowding that takes place in our housing stock, and we hear about it anecdotally when we go to our community advisory council meetings, but it's a very difficult problem to address. They're overcrowding because they can't afford to pay the rent on their own housing, and our options are very limited. So if we could legally defend sending our code enforcement staff in when we found more people per 110 square feet were living in a dwelling, well, where would they go? We would be essentially asking them to be evicted.
Okay. I wanted to ask staff between coastal and inland, Title 22 and Title 23, if there are any other differences besides the zoning for the emergency shelters, if there's any other differentiation on the transitional and the supportive housing.
Nope, transitional and supportive housing would be the same throughout inland and coastal. Basically, they'd be allowed anywhere single-family, multifamily dwellings are allowed in both areas.
Okay. Then on page 1-6, where we talk about security during hours of operation of the emergency shelters, do we have flexibility on the number of security guards required?
Yes, you do.
So we could require one for any shelter with any numerical...
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And then up to maybe kick it up to two for over 50.
Yeah, they leave that. The state law is pretty broad on that one. It just basically says security during hours of operation. They don't tell you anything more, so you do have some flexibility there.
It seems to me with any shelter, that security may need to be provided. So,
I'll just ask, is security provided at the homeless shelter here in San Luis Obispo over a certain number of people?
No. The Homeless Services Director is saying no.
SCD out there. Okay, just...
Well, that would be good if she would have spoke during public comment, because it'd be...
We might, yeah.
Well,
we're, you know...
Object, then that would be transitional or supportive housing. But okay. If it's a facility, it's not.
Yeah. I think I thought I had something in the actual ordinance proposal that I had a question on the language... Oh, we went over that on the transitional housing definition. So I think that's it for me for now. Thank you.
Good question. Commissioner Mouskow, you want to have any
questions?
No,
no more
questions
right now.
No. And then back to Commissioner O'Grady.
Okay, thank you. I had a question on the environmental analysis. Several times, I'll try to find, under several of the categories, there was a statement made that, well, since no specific projects have been approved, then there's no environmental impact that's been identified, so... then it's a negative declaration. I sure have a problem with that kind of reasoning. Maybe it's so subtle I'm missing it. Could you speak to that, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Jeff Oliveira, environmental staff. And what we prepared for this new ordinance is referred to as a programmatic negative declaration. As an example, we did a programmatic EIR for the conservation element. And so when a local or a lead agency prepares a program like a new ordinance that could ostensibly have an impact on the environment, we're required by law to do CEQA environmental review. However, we have to limit that review to the actual impacts that would be caused by the program. Obviously, when you're creating a program like this, there's no specific development proposed. It's really just paperwork. And therefore, we do this program analysis that focuses on the likely impacts that could be introduced as part of implementing the program. But we also have to be responsible and not speculate on what could be developed and where. Without knowing what may be developed and where, we can't really get into project-specific impacts, like so many square feet of wetland could be impacted, for example. Given that, we have to decide, you know, from a general level, what could be the impacts. And I think we did a good job going through each of these sections, talking about what the potential impacts could be. And then we also fall back on the fact that, as Morgan introduced in her presentation, the various triggers that could put a project under this program into discretionary review. One thing that was left out is any of these future development that could come under this ordinance that triggers major grading, which is 50 cubic yards of disturbance. would also trigger discretionary review. So we've got these triggers that we can rely on for further review down the line. And then we've also got a big list of development standards for these land use areas that get into all the applicable ordinances, policies, laws, local, state, and federal, that would apply to any development, including ministerial, that would address these specific impacts, and we outline them in each section. So given the absence of an actual development project, that's the goal of a programmatic NAG deck like the one you saw.
Well, it seems to me that what you just said is kind of another reason why, and let me be specific, the difficulty of identifying impacts ahead of time without knowing what the specific site is that you're talking about, that's a difficulty. In fact, we had an item on our agenda here a few meetings ago in a community where there was a lot of concern about the meager law enforcement
services that and their mitigation gets triggered by ordinance. So you know, it just falls back to the fact that we couldn't in good faith assume what can be built where as far as this project goes, but we lay out, you know, all the requirements regardless of discretionary ministerial permits, what would be required, and, you know, by point of reference, what would trigger further discretionary review and more environmental review. So that was the goal of our negative declaration, was to really highlight the fact that a lot of these impacts will be taken care of through existing ordinances and policies.
So by discretionary review, do you mean coming before the Planning Commission and giving the public a chance to communicate their ideas and concerns?
Well, I was more focusing on the environmental impact assessment required under discretionary review, so that would be the CEQA. There's different levels of discretionary permits that would trigger Planning Commission review or department review.
Perhaps you could address the broader opportunities or limitations on those opportunities for public input as far as the impact of this proposed ordinance.
Yeah, so basically there would, if an emergency shelter was proposed in one of those three land use categories we talked about, and it didn't trigger one of those, like a historic area or airport review, one of those triggers, then it would be ministerial, and there would not really be a public process. It's just a zoning clearance is what we call it. But in any other situation, if it does trigger one of those, if there's not community water and sewer, and then there is the discretionary process, so they would go through some sort of hearing.
Okay, so how does that differ from the current situation?
I'll try to tackle that one. The county so far does not have a definition on the books for what an emergency shelter is. So typically we've looked at them and tried to evaluate them as residential care facilities. It's a square peg in a round hole, but that's what we have. And they're subject to environmental review determination. Is there, you know, we would do an initial study. If it looks like there's some significant potential impacts, we do more analysis. The package before you today would say, in some circumstances, there may be the possibility that a homeless shelter will be proposed, and it will qualify for a ministerial permit. There won't be an initial study and a negative declaration or an EIR. But those triggers, and if it's all right with the chair, I'll read through them, are quite a few of them. So if it's not in a historic area or airport review area or a flood area, hazard area or energy or extractive resource area, a geologic study area, a sensitive resource combining designation, open space agreement, navigation easement, water or soil contamination, or very high fire hazard. And as well, Jeff mentioned, if the proposal is big enough, it doesn't have to be real big to trigger our grading analysis, then there would be environmental review triggered. So it is fairly limited.
With the environmental review, would that would trigger a discretionary application?
That's what I'm saying. The discretionary review would trigger the environmental review.
Only for those items.
Right. And while we're on that, if I could interrupt again, residential care facilities, you referenced those. Do they currently require discretionary permits?
For seven or more persons, I believe.
Seven
trigger,
or more.
But for six or fewer, I think it's a zoning clearance. Yeah.
Okay.
It sounds like we have some better understanding of what we're doing with the transitional and supportive aspects of this ordinance.
I had one more question on the transitional.
Okay.
Now that I got past the wording that I had wrong, that I thought was wrong,
there you go.
I picked up that they're I wanted to talk a little bit more about how they're operated under program requirements. So is there state permitting or registration of these housing units so that there is some sort of oversight?
Typically, yes. Programs are usually funded by grants, which have program requirements. It's not clear, unfortunately, in the law. I don't know if Tim could weigh in, but I don't know if program requirements would always have to be federally funded or if an agency could have their own program with their own rules.
And they could be state funded as well. But generally those funding programs have a number of rules that have to be complied with on the operation of it. It's not the same.
And there's no particular individual that applies that has to register at that particular time, but next week someone moves in. So would there be a notification to potential purchasers or renters that there's a transitional facility or home there to where they need to be aware that that's a possibility?
No. This doesn't really affect the whole Megan's Law framework, and that applies now, whether it's a single-family dwelling normal or it's transitional housing normal. They still have to comply with Megan's Law. The planning department doesn't enforce that, but it's still there. We're not saying it's perfect, but it's still there.
Okay, thank you. That's it. Sorry.
Okay, and Commissioner Grady, you had further questions? Or?
Yes. Some of what Commissioner White had to say prompted another question. The ordinance proposes to locate emergency shelters in commercial service land use category, industrial category, and public facility category. I have a pretty good idea of commercial service, what the ordinance includes as far as commercial service types of spaces. There's, I guess, primarily businesses in those types of spaces, and please correct me if I say something in error here. And then industrial would be similar. And then public facility, maybe you could clarify for me what would be included in that particular land use category. And then maybe you could address your rationale for why you are suggesting that these three categories, particularly commercial service and industrials, seem to me to be not have much to do with people living there, with housing, and so I'm curious about those things.
Well, I can explain some of the uses that are allowed currently in public facility. It might help a little bit. For example, lodging, hotels, and motels. Yeah, and so that's considered a transient use, and that's one of the major, and so that's allowed in public facility and commercial service right now, 40 or more units of hotels and motels. Yeah.
And part of the rationale was we were looking for zoning categories that weren't primarily residential neighborhoods in character. These are also, if a homeless shelter goes into one of these areas, we expect there would be a fair amount of traffic coming in and out of service vehicles. They could be County Department of Mental Health or Social Services or others. And so it acts more like a commercial operation, even though people are living there at night.
Okay, thank you. That helps out a lot.
Okay, I don't see any more lights, which means we're ready to move, I'm sure. I don't really feel like we have a lot of... I think staff has made clear that regarding transitional and supportive, the language there, that really is basically just clarifying, according to state law, what the county is doing already. My interpretation or my reading of it says that we don't have a lot of options to use this as a way to, further notification requirements under Megan's law and that kind of thing. That's not what this is about. This is just that aspect of this ordinance is pretty limited and pretty clear, but I could be wrong, but that's the way I'm looking at it. What I'm hearing from my two commissioners is that you might want to take a little closer look at the emergency shelter aspects and tweak some of those 8 requirements, or are you wanting to have staff come back with entirely new options, or where are you thinking you might want to go? There's 2 of you.
I'm reminded of the maxim, act in haste and repent at leisure, and this is complex enough, at least for me, to try to get my arms around it. I spent a lot of time at home trying to understand the ins and outs of this, and I've learned a lot today from staff and from my colleagues. But as I started out with my comments, I think that the Senate bill offers some other approaches here. For example, just one zone where the discretion disappears instead of 3, and that doesn't take them off the table, so everyone who wants to maximize the chances for shelters, can it hasn't compromised that at all, but it's just listed with a CUP rather than an A on the table. So I guess I would like staff to go back through the law and I just don't think I can understand it and do it justice on the fly like this.
Okay,
so,
I understand.
But I'll sit here and listen some more, and if I can, I will.
Okay, Commissioner White, where are you at with this?
I'm in agreement with Commissioner Grady on that. I would like to explore other options. I'm somewhat troubled that in the residential aspect of this, we may not have any other options. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to support it because of that. You know, with the governor's early prison release program, this could be exacerbated throughout our county as far as the transitional housing part of this. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's a real dilemma, and I don't think it will be accepted. If this thing does take off, there's a multitude of these, I don't think it's going to be accepted in the neighborhoods. And I know it will not be equitable either, because I believe, and Tim might want to speak to this, a lot of the newer neighborhoods are set up with CCNRs that would not allow any of these types of facilities or housing. So I don't know if that will create inequities out there in the community where they'll be forced into other locations. So I have some real concerns on that. And I would like to explore other options, and I don't know if we can do anything in our ordinances to get some sort of oversight on this or some sort of notification to the residents in the neighborhood. So I'm really concerned about the impacts, and again, I wouldn't be able to make the findings that we normally have to make here about detriment to a neighborhood or compatibility.
Okay. I'm going to talk to Commissioner Melska and make my own comments, and then what I'd like you two gentlemen to think about is if you could, to give, assuming we're going to have to come back with this, to try to make a short list to staff of specific issues you'd like them to be looking at when they come back. For instance, you talked about, I mean, you heard the word security, one zone, that type of thing, so they have a better idea of exactly what your concerns are. You may get outvoted at the next meeting anyway, but we'll find out. Commissioner Melskow, where are you?
Well, the staff stated that they had studied this for a year or a year and a half, and I'm wondering, by extending this 1 week, if what more they could come up with. I would think that they probably have the answers right now, and I don't extending 1 week, I don't see what we're gaining by that.
Okay. I also am comfortable with staff's analysis and the language and intent of this ordinance. I absolutely cannot see the benefit to the community and to our homeless to restrict further to one zone. I'm not concerned about the security issues in the sense that what I heard staff say was that they had actually consulted with all the folks who do handle homeless shelters, and they're pretty comfortable with the kinds of requirements that they put into this proposed language. But I certainly understand the concerns of our two commissioners, so we have another meeting, we can deal with this. Gives us a chance to come back for our $138 one more time. Unless we can actually move on this, we might as well go ahead and give our staff feedback and have them come back and then deal with it again.
Well, and if I just would say, I think what Commissioner Christensen, one thing she just said, illustrates the need to reflect on this, in that you said that something about limiting it to one zone. That is not what the effect of my remarks would be. I'm saying you can recognize homeless shelters in every zone as long as there's a conditional use permit
right in
the table and not a ministerial
right.
permit.
But I know that.
Oh, okay, but I didn't hear that.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is when you start adding conditional use permits and minor use permits to the process of doing these kinds of things, you add immeasurably to the costs and the efforts. And to me, that goes against the intent of this ordinance in the first place. But that's, the debate we need to continue to have. So do I hear a motion? Do we motion to continue to date certain? Is that what we're talking about? Oh, not yet. Well, we first want to give our feedback.
Yeah, I'd like to make some more comments.
So could I get some, Commissioner White first?
As far as continuing this, from my perspective, it may be an exercise in futility unless staff can come back with some alternatives and options. My concerns don't lie as much with the emergency shelters of where they're being proposed as it does with the residential. We may not have any options there. And so, again, I'm ready to vote no, because even though the state's mandating this residential aspect, we're just making a recommendation to the board, and my recommendation is no. And the board may not be able to do anything about it, but I'm not going to give a yes that I support this, because I don't.
Sure. Well, I'd like a chance for us to have a more complete discussion, and so I'm willing to continue it rather than bring it to a vote right now. I mean, I don't know where staff wants this to go, but...
You'd need three positive votes to move it on anyway, so it sounds like a continuance might be the best thing to do today.
Okay, so you're not particularly interested in...
Rather than in the inland zone, for example. And then one zone versus, as far as ministerial, three zones rather than one. So there are, and then the law does offer other options as well. So, and then I offered some, like planning for specific sites, and I know some objections were voiced about that, but maybe they could be put into a staff report so I can stare at them for a while and think about them. I just want to be sure we've explored all of the options, that we have a menu to choose what we think is best for all parties in the community, and I just don't think we have that enough.
One more request to staff, and I promise this is it for me. I have a concern about these lineations of these of different categories of supported transitional and emergency shelter getting crossed over. So if we can take a look at how we prevent that from happening if possible, specifically minimum size of emergency shelter, so that transitional housing or supported housing aren't used as homeless shelters. And that I don't know if there's a way to prevent that, but if we could take a look at that. Thank you.
To clarify the difference between those things.
So staff can make sure we understand that the direction here. We will come back at your next hearing, provide some options that look like they might be possible under the law, pursuant to Commissioner Grady's suggestion. We'll look at this CRLA document that you're referencing.
If we can't find it,
we may contact you. I'm sure we can find
it. The rural legal assistance.
But as a practical matter, we would come back with a recommended ordinance still, because it's problematic for us just to list a lot of options and then we can't incorporate them in an ordinance and have county council review it that same day very easily.
You may come back with the exact same. I mean, I presume
we'll come back with a recommended ordinance. I don't know if it will be exactly the same as today, but
But you could, I mean, you could have your recommended ordinance, even if it is exactly the same as today, but then on another page, you could say, okay, instead of item A, you could have, here's a couple options instead of what we're proposing, and then item B, it's sort of a menu on a separate sheet, maybe.
As a
structural suggestion.
Okay, so do I have a motion to continue to a date certain, July 1st?
Oh, sure, I'll move, so move.
All right.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to consider hearing item 1 regarding the proposal to amend Titles 21 and 23 of the County Code, blah, 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 to July 1st, regular meeting of July 1st. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. That's what we're going to be doing then. Sorry, Warren, wherever you are out there. And Stephan. Okay, now we're going to have a little break for 15 minutes to 10:45. Call this meeting back to order. Are we ready? I'm sorry, I'm a couple minutes late. All right, we're on to hearing item 2. And Ramona, will you please introduce it?
Hearing to consider a request by Ron and Sharon Betancourt for a third time extension of a minor use permit, coastal development permit. County file number DRC 2003-00145. Supervisorial District Number 3, Terry Waller, Project Manager.
Okay, before we get into our staff report, do I have any ex partes to report? Okay, I didn't have any either. Mr. Waller.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Planning Commissioner. It's Terry Waller, Planning Staff. The item before you is the third time extension of a minor use permit approved on September 16, 2005. The first and second time extensions were approved by the Planning Director, and the Land Use Ordinance requires the third time extension to go to the Planning Commission. The project was a minor use permit, coastal development permit, to allow 6,000 square foot two-story residence and a garage on a 17,000 square foot parcel. The site is located within San Luis Bay Estates, overlooking Avila Beach. It's in the residential suburban land use category and is surrounded by open space. And as you can see in this slide, the area development, there's kind of a mixture of built-out lots and lots that have already got residences on them. The property to the east of this site has a residence built on it. And the areas on either side, other sides of the lot, are actually in open space. So it only has one fronting neighbor. The site plan shows the basic layout of the residence on...
Commissioners, I'm going to go ahead and open it up to public comment. Once again, our vast audience leaps up. Do we have anything from our applicant? No? No? Do you want to come up and talk? No? Okay. We're in a good mood today. I'm sure
we don't bite.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and bring it back to the commission for discussion and action. This is my district, and I don't have any questions. I read through the original findings and conditions, and, of course, our findings for our third-time extension. I'm fine with them, but perhaps we have any comments or questions or discussion from our commissioners?
I'm ready for a motion, Madam.
Then you want to go ahead and make it for me?
Oh, you don't want
to? No, I'm chair. I'm going to be chair today.
Okay, then I make a motion that we approve the third-time extension to extend the approval period until June 10, 2011, pursuant to 2302.050 for this minor use permit, coastal development permit, based on findings in Exhibit A and carry over the original findings and conditions outlined in the attached staff report.
You hear a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner White, a second by Commissioner Malskow. Roll call, please, Ramona, just for fun.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Malskow?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Chairperson Christensen?
Yes. Okay, excellent work, Commission. I'm impressed. And thank you very much, Mr. Waller, and onward, another year. There you go. Okay, that's... I've been pretty good at these third-time extensions during this economic time. Yeah, it was a pretty clean application in the first place. Okay, so we have a few moments while we have a little staff transition here, while we get ready for our hearing item 3. I'm going to wait, count to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. Ramona, would you like to introduce hearing item 3?
Hearing to consider a request by Vina Robles Incorporated for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2007-0200. Supervisorial District 1, Holly Phipps, Project Manager.
Thank you, Ramona. Before Holly speaks and gives a report, do we have any ex parte on this one? Nope. Okay. Ms. Phipps.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Planning Commission. Holly Phipps, Project Manager. Before you today is the request for the construction of approximately 76,000 square foot wine processing facility. Case production would be limited to a 100,000 cases annually. And of special note, no special events and no public tasting has been authorized or requested. The proposed project is located directly adjacent and west of Paso Robles Urban Reserve Line. It is located on the south side of Union Road, approximately a half a mile southeast of Highway 46. The project is located in the agricultural land use category. It is in the airport review area, and it is in the Elpar Mar Australia planning area. The next few slides, quickly, they don't come in that good, is the site plan. Option 2 for the ag ponds and fire suppression ponds is located here, and another option, as noted in the staff report, is directly behind the winery. Elevations, floor plans, this is the lower level, upper level, a little aerial here showing a little more detail of the site, and then just backing it out a ways. This area directly behind here is under Vina Robles' control of, they've got like 800 and some acres of land, and I believe like 524 produces grapes. With that, staff is recommending, before that, on page 39 of the staff report, 13A, a little typo where it says 9.87 acres, it should actually read 29.61 acres.
Where was that, please? Repeat that.
39, 13A.
And it's instead of 9.87, it is what?
29.61.
Thank you.
Holly, were all the calculations done on the 29.61?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, staff is recommending adoption of the negative declaration in accordance with CEQA. Number 30 is air quality,
yes.
And the other one is for kit fox mitigation.
Yes.
When
so we, in the past, we've reduced them both to 15 miles per hour, and
that
the applicants
makes sense.
Haven't
the
seen
most restrictive.
The
okay.
Applicants, I'd hate for them to post 25
yes.
mile an hour signs and then they don't comply.
Thank you.
The applicants in the past have been agreeable to going with the 15 mile per hour, so maybe before they speak, if they have an issue with that, they can let us know. And then I guess I saw Commissioner O'Grady's comments and letter, and is this in the Australia sub-basin of the Paso Robles groundwater basin?
Yes.
Okay. We've had a lot of testimony on other projects that, you know, it's in distress, so could you speak a little bit to the groundwater situation there?
We have Mr. Conger here, and he can address your questions about this area.
Maybe we should wait until after.
Can we wait until after we have public comment?
I just didn't know if you had anything in your presentation regarding waters, but we can wait until after the applicants.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of get into those more substantive issues once we've heard from our public. Once again, I have a vast number of flips here. don't have any problem. Do we have a report from the applicant? Can if you could fill out a public comment slip and give it to me after your comments, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Tim Woodle with Poulton Associates Architects. Good morning. Holly, I do have just a very quick presentation I'd like to run through. There's several items in there. One of them should be a PowerPoint. I'll go through these exhibits very quickly. Some of them you've already seen, frankly, the site plan and the floor plans. Mainly, we do have some exterior renderings, 3D models that we'd like to show since the 2D elevations perhaps don't do the best job of explaining the design. Overall site plan, which again you have seen, Union Road down at the bottom of the sheet. This is an enlarged site plan, just essentially the same exhibit jumping up in scale, showing one of the existing wells, detention and retention basins. Main level floor plan, this is a gravity flow winery. I think you've seen a few of these types of designs from our firm before. Fruit comes in actually up at the top in this gray shaded area, runs through the floor and drops down to inside processing. This is, again, one of those wineries that the vast majority of the processing will be inside. And then I'll just quickly run through these renders, give you a feel for it. It's a large building. We've tried to, that came out dark. We've tried to really break the scale of the building down, and I apologize if these are reading so dark. It's the backside, the crush pad.
Here, can I?
Okay, yeah. Good. Westview. This is an aerial from the northwest. The arcade that you see down here in the lower left-hand side, some of you, or maybe all of you, are familiar with the Viva Robles Hospitality Center, which is over on Highway 46 and Mill Road, pulling some key elements from that project over to this project. But as is stated in the staff report, this is not intended to be a public venue. It's essentially a production facility. Clearly an upscale, world-class production facility, but it's intended to be a production facility. Detail shot, night shot. And with that, if anybody needs to back up to any of those, I'm happy to do that. Ms. Phipps did provide me a copy of some questions that were raised by one of the commissioners, and I don't have that complete document in front of me. You may need to refresh me on a little bit of it, but I'd like to start with the issue of water. The winery itself, we use a figure of 10 gallons per case for larger wineries, 14 gallons per case for small wineries, winery up in 100,000 case range. We would certainly apply that 10 gallons per case, million gallons a year, round numbers, that's about 3 acre feet. Similar to the Niner Winery project, which was completed prior to harvest last year, 200 gallons a minute to about 600 gallons per minute. And I believe we have 3 potential wells that could serve this facility. 6 total wells on the ranch and 3 that we could select from to serve this property. Typically, we pick one well and we dedicate it to the commercial use so that we're not blending irrigation well water with domestic well water. With respect to the health department permits, we're familiar with those requirements. In the initial stages, since we're not open to the public and we will have less than 25 employees, I expect what we're going to hear from the health department is we don't need the health department permit per se. At some point, we will get to the threshold that we will need that permit. With respect to the footprint of the kitchen, we are indicating a commercial kitchen. It's a kitchen that would be permitted through the Environmental Health Department. It is in no way, shape, or form a restaurant. That said, I can certainly understand the spirit of the question. Frankly, we have not done a technical layout of the kitchen. The actual interior footprint of that kitchen is about 1,025 square feet. We had some very, very thick walls depicted on the floor plans. If we took that outside square footage, I think that gets us up to the 1,200 square feet that's referenced. The reality is, if this is a sticking point for anybody, we would accept a condition that limited the kitchen to 800 square feet. It's not a make or break for us. The kitchen is really to serve our retail and wholesale trade customers, our distribution network, and frankly, to provide meals for employees. So at 800 square feet, I think we could still do everything that we needed to do. With that, I'm available to answer any other questions that you have, and we appreciate the opportunity to present.
Okay, it looks like we have a couple questions for our applicant. Might as well take care of them now, as long as they're real questions. Commissioner White, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, your existing wells, have you experienced any drop in elevation or any distress on those wells?
I don't know if you could hear the response.
Yeah.
There certainly are seasonal fluctuations in the well, but his comment was that they are stabilizing because now that the vineyards are established, we're using significantly less water on the vineyards than we were in the initial startup and establishment periods. So generally speaking, we feel pretty good about the quantity and quality of water that we have.
Good, thank you. That's it.
Okay, Commissioner O'Grady.
Yes, Mr. Woodall. Is Vina Robles, does Vina Robles Winery have the sustainability and practice certificate seal or whatever?
On the vineyard side?
Well, I confess I don't know all of the requirements. What I do know is that it I thought it applied to the production building.
I have to admit that I'm not completely following the question or understanding.
Well, it's a way to minimize the pardon me?
It's the SIP program?
Yeah.
The SIP program that some of the, all the environmental things about water and about...
Oh, if we're talking about best management practices?
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that's
okay,
good.
All right. Okay, so you anticipated nicely my question about when I saw those roof area, and I thought... So you're going to have a rainwater catchment system, so you won't mind if we condition the project to have that then?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I sent out some questions to Ms. Phipps, and, you know, my calculator malfunctioned. I've moved a decimal point when I shouldn't have, so I'm scraping some egg off my face right now on that one. But Ms. Phipps was very patient with me on that, so I appreciate that. Let's see. Okay, you did address the kitchen. And so you are designing this as a commercial kitchen that will... that when health department requirements are triggered, it will, the design of the kitchen will meet the health department standards for ventilation and three compartment sinks and all the rest. Is that correct?
Yes, that's accurate.
Okay. And you'd like to have the extra 200 square feet or just have it as a cushion because you haven't done the design yet?
We'd like to have it as a cushion when
yeah.
we... Really, the factors that drive the kitchen, size of the scullery, size of the frozen dry goods and refrigerated food storage.
Right.
If we do reach-ins.
How often you're planning on these and what the impact would be in terms of cars and
given the fact that we have the hospitality center
uh-huh.
and that truly is an event venue. It was
right.
designed, permitted, entitled as an event venue. The kitchen in that particular facility is substantially larger than 800 square feet, for example. So the majority of our events would occur there. What we're really envisioning at the winery itself, a marketing group comes to town. They're taken out for tours of the Vina Robles holdings, the vineyards. They may go to the hospitality center for a lunch, but as part of that day, they would most certainly do a tour of the production winery. I would expect the size of that group to be anywhere from 2 to 10, maybe 15 people.
Okay.
If the hours coincided, there may be a lunch that's served for those folks. I don't think that falls into the standards for events.
Right.
Similarly, though, and maybe more directly to your question, if PRVGA, who has monthly meetings, and they move them around, they've had them at Vina Robles,
right.
those could occur there. We're not charging a fee. They're not advertised to the public. So my sense is if they are specific to that trade organization, that's not an event, but I think I'll have to defer to planning if they disagree.
Karen Novick, Planning Division. Yeah, we wouldn't consider that an event. That's
okay.
Normal business practices for the wine industry.
Got it. Let's see. Okay, well, thank you. You answered my questions.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Malska, you had a question?
Yes, I have one. Did you consider solar panels?
We are considering solar panels. I will say that is not one that I'd be on the surface willing to just accept a blanket condition of approval, given my perception, at least, of the volatility of price in that commodity and the capital investment. But we most certainly are committing to engineering the building to accept rooftop solar, and it's our client's desire to explore it seriously and implement it. I'd prefer a recommendation as opposed to a requirement.
Where, if and when they are put in, where would they be located?
We would locate them on the roofs themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We have fairly flat sloped roofs, and I think we're actually sloping in all four compass directions. So obviously we would start with the southern orientation and lay those panels as flat as possible. But what we have found is if you get into other orientations, you can kick the panels up at an angle to capture the optimum solar. But it would be a rooftop installation.
But the roof would take the load from the panels?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for applicant? For now? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any members of the public? Because now forever hold your peace. So controversial. I'm going to go ahead and bring this back to the commission for discussion, more questions, maybe some action. Let's see, Commissioner White, it is in your district. You want to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think staff, we'd give them an opportunity to respond, and I believe Mr. Conger was here to speak to the water issue.
Okay, Mr. Conger.
Good morning, Michael Conger, County Planning Staff. As Ms. Phipps indicated, this project is in the Estrella area of concern within the Paso Robles groundwater basin, as it's been mapped by both FUGRO and TOT engineers in previous studies. The most recent study we have is from FUGRO. It's dated March 2010, and it says that there is between about 1 to 4% of additional water available before we reach the perennial yield in that basin, and that represents about 9,700 acre feet per year. This project would be using about 3 acre feet per year, which we consider to be a negligible number. It's about 1/30th of 1% of that available use. And additionally, we consider that to be an agricultural water use, not a non-agricultural water use, which is treated differently in our general plan, specifically Ag Policy 11, which prioritizes agricultural water use over non-agricultural water use. So that is why in the initial study we identified this as not being a significant impact on water availability. And I'm available for any questions on that.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes, Mr. Conger. Recently we had another project come before us that was also in the Estrella area, and it was a housing project, and staff is recommending denial, as I recall, solely because it was going to be using water from that sub-basin, and So I recommendation with respect to water on that project and on this one, and perhaps you could speak to that.
There's three key differences between the project you're referencing, which I believe was it was based on a special finding that's required only of agricultural cluster subdivisions, and that finding requires that the commission assert that there is a long-term sustainable available water supply to serve residential and agricultural uses on the site.
Okay, you quoted a percentage that the 3 acre feet is with respect to, 9,700 acre feet potential remaining yield?
And that's in the reasonable worst case that FUGRO presented, the 1% case. Of course, that number would be higher on the 4% case.
So what percent did you quote earlier?
1/30th of 1% of that 9,770 acre feet per year.
Okay, so on that other project, if it's equivalent to two houses and it was 18, that would be a difference of 9 times, so that would be 9/30ths of 1%.
And additionally, in the Astoria project, we also had to account for about another 100 acres of irrigated grapes, which at 138 acre feet per year, that's roughly 1.5% of that 9,770 available acre feet.
So we're throwing these percentages around, but it's not like it was an objective criteria, pass-fail or anything like that. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're currently working on a resource capacity study. We brought a draft of that study to your commission about a year ago, around May or June of 2009. And we were then directed to go back to the drawing board, get this FUGRO study done, and then come back with an updated resource capacity study, which we will be doing probably in the coming months. And that resource capacity study will have a lot more of the answers. Until we have that resource capacity study done, we're looking at these on a case-by-case basis and making an assessment of whether the additional water use would be significant or insignificant. And in this case, we said it's below that level of significance.
Thank you for that very clear explanation. I appreciate it.
Commissioner White, you have questions?
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Conger. I'm not sure this is a question for you, but you made a comment that this water is considered agricultural use. Seems to be a little bit of a conflict. This is a general, not necessarily specific to this project. Maybe it's a question for the Ag Department. But on page 3-4 of our staff report, they speak to the project like it's not agricultural use. They speak to it that on the middle of the page, it talks about to ensure the project's consistent with agricultural policies 8 and 18, the project will have less than a significant impact on agricultural resources. In my mind, that's indicating that this isn't really agricultural use. That because it could have an impact on the agricultural resources. And down at the bottom of the page, it says a proposed project will have less than a significant impact on agricultural resources. So again, it's being treated as non-agricultural because it can impact agricultural. So to make the water, it seems like the water analysis is in conflict with that. And again, I think we're fine here with everything. That's just a general question that comes.
I think it's really two different levels of analysis. This analysis was done on the impact to agricultural resources, and when the Ag Department looks at agricultural resources, they're looking at things like soil types and the ability to produce crops or livestock on the land.
Strictly so, crop, not support facilities.
They're not specifically looking at agricultural processing facilities. However, we would consider an agricultural processing facility that's using water to be an agricultural use of water.
Okay, thank you. That's a good explanation.
I might add to that explanation. In Table 2-2 of the Land Use Ordinance, ag processing is included in the agricultural grouping of uses. It is considered an agricultural use in our land use ordinance.
It would be good if Mr. Eisensee were here because it would be good to get them at it because they're relocating their ponds because it's has a negative impact.
My understanding, just to leap in here, is that even though it is an agricultural use, this winery production facility, there is still a policy about fragmenting land, and it's the fragmenting land part of the agricultural policies that the ponds are concerning, not that it's not an agricultural use, but
just
that it's just the siting of it. So That's a little bit of a nuance there.
Thank you. That's a good answer. I just saw that as a little confusing for me too,
but then I realized that it's two different aspects of agricultural use that they're addressing.
And Karen, I'll just to beat the dead horse, the Ag Department actually takes apart the project also. They're looking at the kitchen. They're looking at the parking lot, the landscaping. So they're taking apart the project and seeing how they can minimize the impacts to the soil, basically, to the land.
Okay, thank you.
So to beat the horse a little bit more, is that why the parking was reduced?
Exactly.
Okay.
Do we have any dogs and ponies we can use?
Okay, Commissioner Wyatt, are you still wanting to speak? Or you, do you have any more questions?
I'm ready to make a motion unless
okay.
there's other
Do other we have any more comments or questions from Commissioner O'Grady or Commissioner Malta? Okay, just before you make a, I don't have any more questions, Commissioner White, but I did hear there were two conditions that needed to be changed that we talked about before we even got to our discussion regarding the typo on the acreage and the 15 mile per hour. And then there was some discussion about limiting the kitchen square feet.
Mounted solar fields up to 4.5 acres are allowed on a ministerial permit level. Is that... Ring striking a chord
with
anybody?
Leap in.
Karen Nall, I'm not aware of that state law. We've had quite a few wineries come in. We've looked at them case by case for solar, for ground-mounted solar. Warren, Mr. Hogue, are you familiar with any state law of that sort?
I'm not saying there isn't. I'm just not familiar.
Yeah.
Okay, then I guess I'd like to just go on the record and say we are considering ground-mounted solar in that area.
Okay. Well, I could suggest a conditional condition that would say something to the effect that the roof system shall be engineered to accept solar panels with ground-mounted panels only allowed to the extent prescribed by law.
Great.
Is that so?
That'd be wonderful.
So,
yeah.
If you can do them on the ground, you know, fine.
Thank you.
Okay, does that make sense, Mr. White?
Yes, it does.
Okay, you want to go ahead with your motion then?
Do we want to? Do we correct the other conditions? I appreciate your catching me. Did we get 15 miles per hour?
Page 3.3-9, condition number 13A changed 9.87 acres to 29.61 acres. Page 3-11. Change condition 15 to 15 miles per hour for the Kit Fox to match the air quality 15 miles per hour. And then I don't know whether, I think the rainwater catchment system condition would be, that's a new one, to condition it that they do have a rainwater catchment system. And then the rooftop solar thing would be a new one. Is that right?
Correct, and we can make those as ongoing conditions.
Whatever.
Just a 50 and a 51.
Okay.
We need those read into the record, or does staff want to put the language? We'll just acknowledge here that they're happening. Okay, with that, I'll make a motion. We adopt a negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21,000, and approve conditional use permit DRC 2007-00200 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions as modified listed in Exhibit B and read into the record.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is staff clear on the additional conditions 50 and 51?
Yes.
Okay. Motion and a second. Ramona, want to go ahead and read the roll?
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Malskow?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Chairperson Christensen?
Yes. Okay.
Good luck.
4-0. Thank you very much. Good job, staff, and thank you, applicants. Onward. Okay, we come to... We have a little staff change here as we get ready for hearing number 4. And... take this opportunity to thank my commission for their expeditious work here, making my job easy and getting me out of here by 5 p.m. tonight. That will be very much appreciated by my employers.
I'll even buy you lunch
today. Hey.
It's so hard.
Thank you so much. But anyway, Mr. Singwall, are you ready? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask Ramona to go ahead and do your thing.
Parents to consider a request by Cuesta Community College and Verizon Wireless for a development plan, coastal development permit, county file number DRC 2008-00082, Supervisorial District Number 2, Erlen Singwall, Project Manager.
Okay, before Mr. Singwal gets started, can I ask for any ex partes from my commission?
No.
No? And take it away, Mr. Singwal.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the commission, Erlen Singwal, planning staff. So this project is a request by the San Luis Obispo Community College District, hereinafter referred to as Cuesta College, and Verizon Wireless to construct and operate an unmanned three-carrier wireless telecommunications facility. The proposed project would remove an existing unpermitted 100-foot-tall lattice tower and associated Cellular One and Nextel communications facilities and replace that facility with a new facility located approximately on the same property about 200 feet to the east. That new facility would consist of 36 panel antennas, 12 antennas for each of the three carriers on three monopines of 35 feet, 45 feet, and 60 feet in height. The facility would also consist of three equipment shelters, one jurisdiction of the site, and determine that actually that existing tower should have received a land use permit and a coastal development permit and therefore was an unpermitted structure. So Verizon Wireless worked with the property owner, Cuesta College, to submit an application that would legalize it would address the code violation by removing the unpermitted tower and installing this new three-carrier communications facility that would be able to accommodate the antennas for Cellular One and Nextel as well as Verizon's proposed facility. So here is the land use category map. The project is located at 3535 Education Drive. It's along Highway 1, just across from the main Cuesta College campus. The project site is in the agriculture and land use category, and you can see it's located well across from Cuesta College, about midway between Morro Bay and the city of San Luis Obispo. Now here's an aerial image of the subject property. You can see the existing towers are located here. I'm sure you've probably all seen them driving to Morro Bay. And the project site would be located here, again, about 200 feet to the east behind this earthen berm. Here's a photograph of the existing unpermitted tower and the associated Cellular One and Nextel facilities and equipment shelters, which would be removed as part of this project. And these facilities would have to be removed before Verizon could pull a construction permit to construct the new facility. And the applicant can talk more about the logistics of that. Here's a photograph of the existing berm. You can see it's essentially uncompacted fill material that's been disposed of here. Of course, the project would engineer this berm, increase it in height, and landscape it. Here's the proposed site plan. Again, existing facilities located here. Proposed facilities to the east. You can see the equipment shelters within the bermed area here. The yellow area shows the berm expansions. The 60-foot and 45-foot, the two tallest monopines, would be located within this bermed area. The 35-foot monopine would be located just out here. And you can see that the proposed landscaping plan, which includes up to 21 trees and about 100 shrubs, would help incorporate the monopines into the site and create that appearance of a stand of trees. It's just a plan of the equipment area, the three equipment shelters, screened from view by the berm, and we see the 60-foot and 45-foot tall monopine. The shorter one's not visible on this plan. So the elevation, you can see how the berm will be extended in height to screen the shelters and the base of these two monopines. Same thing here on the southeast elevation, or southwest and northwest elevations showing the same thing. Now, the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance provides a fairly specific screening standard for communications facilities. The standard states that a communications facility shall be completely screened by existing vegetation or landscaping, and when that's not possible, the facility shall be disguised to resemble some sort of feature that blends with the surrounding rural landscape. So staff worked collaboratively with Verizon and the property owner to design a facility that would comply with the standard. A lot of times when we have an issue involving unpermitted development, we address that by requiring the applicant to submit an as-built permit for the project. Of course, an as-built permit wasn't a viable option in this case because the existing tower is not screened. It silhouettes significantly above the ridgeline and it's visible from a major scenic viewing corridor. So the proposed project brings the site into compliance with this screening standard by creating the disguised facility with the pine trees. And also the project is located in the coastal zone and it's subject to visual and scenic resource coastal plan policies. Just briefly, some of these policies that are most relevant state that development needs to protect and the attractive features and preserve the attractive features of the site. And also, Visual Scenic Resource Coastal Plan Policy 1 states that views should be restored in visually degraded areas. And, of course, the project is consistent with that by removing the unscreened tower and replacing it with a screened stealth design. Policy 2 states that site selection for development should emphasize locations not visible from major viewing corridors. The proposed project moves the communications facilities to a less prominent location, not quite as visible as the three monopines. And the recommendation really was based on looking at, you know, what is the rural, what characterizes the rural landscape in this area. And the visual consultant, Bob Carr, you'll notice that there are various, throughout the Chorro Valley, you see stands of mature trees on hilltops, and that was the model for this project. You can see here these photos are from the visual study showing examples of that. And so here's a photo simulation of the project from Highway 1 northbound. You can see the monopines and the surrounding shrubs and trees planted. So I'm just going to go through a few more photo simulations here. One northbound looking west, the existing tower, and here's the original proposal and the proposed project. Again, southbound Highway 1 looking north, existing, original, proposed. Here, Education Drive, one of the more closer public viewing points, proposed. So, in the staff report, I discussed how there is, even today, a great amount of variation in the quality of design of a monopine. And this slide here is an example of that. You can see on the left, fairly recently constructed monopine, where you can see the antennas are sticking out beyond the branches. The antenna stalks, which is the foliage that goes on top of the antennas, are pretty sparse, don't completely screen the antennas, and is a relatively low branch density, and you can see here there's no bark texture on the monopine. And on the right, we see a better screened monopine where you can't even really make out the shape of the antennas, and you have a greater branch density. As far as how well monopines age, we looked at one of the older monopines in the county. This one is at the Napomo First Baptist Church off of Tet Street, constructed in 2004, and here's a photo of it today. Of course, the lighting is not that great on the current photo, but you can see that it looks like there's been some fading, maybe some loss of branches, but overall they hold up fairly well. And of course, when the monopines do begin to substantially fade and lose branches, that does become a condition compliance issue that we can address through code enforcement if needed. Now, just real briefly, the ordinance does require an alternative analysis to determine the feasibility of co-locating at existing facilities. So the applicant submitted some RF radio frequency propagation maps showing the current gap in coverage for Verizon Wireless. So this is the existing level of Verizon coverage along this Highway 1 corridor. And here's the coverage that would be achieved by the proposed project. You can see the blue here shows the good coverage. And then what Verizon did is prepared a conceptual map showing what the RF propagation would look like if they were to co-locate at one of the nearest existing facilities, which is this Johnson windmill. So if they were to co-locate there and extend the height of that facility to 60 feet, you can see they still would not be able to close that gap in coverage. And also a recently approved site at the El Toro Regional Park, if Verizon were to co-locate there, it also would not be able to close the gap in coverage. That's recommending that the commission adopt a negative declaration and approve the project. I'm available for questions.
I'm going to go ahead and, before the rest of the commissioners speak, and just ask you to please address the letter we received yesterday from Senator One.
Sure. We received a letter from an attorney representing Cellular One. The letter states that the project would interrupt service for Cell One by requiring the existing tower to be removed. Staff's reviewed that with County Council. We believe that really is a civil issue between the carrier, Cellular One, and the property owner, who actually also owns the lattice tower, which is Cuesta College. It's my understanding from Cuesta College, and they can speak to that when they give their presentation, that Cuesta plans to, they're really committed to resolving this code enforcement case, and they plan to remove that tower one way or another, regardless of whether or not this project is approved. They would like to resolve the code enforcement case and get that tower down.
Thank you. And, I just wanted to make a comment. Anybody who's going to speak, I need to have slips. I have one from the applicant. So just if anybody else is going to speak, a slip would be great. Commissioner White, you had some questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Singwald. As far as the removal of the existing facility, could it be done? Is it required to be removed prior to starting the new facility?
Or without the county approval?
Well, maybe the applicant has some history on that, because that seems to be a catch-all for some of these illegal activities.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any questions at this point? The question, Mr. O'Grady.
Yeah, just to follow up on that last point, I understand if there's a shack out back somewhere that the county you can't see it, how are you going to find it as far as code enforcement? But here's a 100-foot tower in a very visible location that's persisted for 10 years, I assumed it had been grandfathered in somehow. But then I read the report, and it wasn't. So I think it's more than just the meter. I like to know how these things happen, and particularly an institution like Cuesta with a department.
There,
maybe the applicants can speak to how that
happens. Yeah, I can speak to that as well. I think one source of confusion on this site, I think there's a couple issues. One is that Cuesta College is divided by the coastal zone, and there is different permit requirements and different jurisdictional issues on depending on which side of the coastal zone development is located. The other issue is that some types of development in some locations of Cuesta College does not require a county permit. So I think what may have happened is there was confusion, and Cuesta and the carriers actually believe the county permit was not required, because a lot of development at Cuesta doesn't require county permits.
Okay. Well, that helps some anyway. You mentioned the berms that are existing there. Where did those come from? How did you characterize them?
Yeah, I'll let the applicant
speak
to that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, we've got 15 minutes left, so does the applicant want to speak now, and then we'll probably close it and bring it back and have more public comment if we're not... we suppose we have a half an hour. I got things to do. But okay, so we are opening a public comment, and our first speaker is Tricia Knight, our applicant's representative.
Good morning. My name is Tricia Knight. I'm representing Verizon Wireless, and staff did a great job of summarizing sort of the timeline of how we got to this project and where we are today. It was also my understanding, and the college is here to speak to this as well, but back when this was originally permitted, that land underneath it was actually owned by the federal government. And he can go into details as to when that actually changed hands, but as you know, 9 times out of 10, usually when it's federally owned land, there are no permits really required by the county for that. When it did become owned by the county at that point, then it becomes susceptible to the permits, and that's how we ended up here today. Just giving a little bit of a background, we approached, our initial preference was to locate on that existing tower. It's already there, lot, you know, available for easy construction, and that at that time is when we were told that there was a violation, and we've been working since a pre-application meeting in 2007 with various designs and reports to get this project to where it is today. We met with Sprint Nextel and Cellular One via conference call, and that was in July of 2009, where we discussed this design. We chose, instead of doing one large structure to house all the carriers, which is the water tank that I saw a little chuckle at, we ended up separating it into these various components to go with all the policies that planning has talked about. We don't wish any of the carriers to be out of service. You know, Verizon knows what it's like when we've run up against this before, and the technology that we understand to be in place is it's called a cell on wheels or a cow, and it's literally a trailer that comes onto the site, is plugged into power, it has antennas on it. It would allow for uninterrupted service for those carriers while we're constructing the new site, and then once that site is turned on, the trailer can very simply be just taken off site. So that was the intention here, was not to have the tower come down and have Cellular One customers without service in that area, or to have Sprint Nextel with that issue as well. And then I'm also here just available to answer any specific questions you might have for me.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and maybe get the rest. We have Mr. Walter here. I have a speaker slip from him, and then maybe come back and ask the applicant questions, because I'd like that way in case he does, he can't.
College representative has a speaker slip. He just hasn't brought it up yet either.
My next one is Mr. Walter Finn from Cellular One, and then we'll go ahead with.
Good morning, commissioners. My name's Bill Walter, and I'm here on behalf of Cellular One, and Bruce Patterson, the general manager, is here as well. We sent a letter yesterday because we had just learned of the staff report and got a copy of it, and we were concerned about having adequate time to evaluate it. So our first request would be that the matter be continued, and hopefully environmental analysis, which talks about no police or fire impacts and the like, is doesn't address that issue unless there is some seamless transition between these services. And also would create a huge hole in the service area for our client, and that would be very, very difficult. You know, Commissioner O'Grady, I kind of shared your kind of wonderment at this. How could this happen? It just doesn't make any sense. Because if there's one thing that cell companies do, especially local ones, I mean, I'm here to promote the local company, it's they get permits, and they get from everybody. And so they live and die by permits, and they go out and they get permits. And that's just something that was very hard to believe, that how could that happen. There are issues about government ownership, federal government ownership, and the transition to Quest and the timing. That's an issue. It's a complicated issue. Quest had retained the services of Tynan and Associates, which was is a well-regarded firm in Santa Barbara, to process this project and to negotiate the leases and comply with the permit conditions and so forth. And I have, again, had a hard time believing, well, how in the world could you have really good firm, trained in the field, they had a whole division doing cellular work, how could they overlook a permit requirement at all? So I contacted Mr. Tynan, and he indicated that their cellular group had split off or been sold off and was separate, that they didn't have any records, but that he would contact different people, which he did. And when he contacted everyone, he reported back to me that there was an existing tower and a radio room, that Cellular One was replacing like for like, an existing tower and an existing facility, that because of that replacement of like for like, there was no permit requirement, and that they had confirmed that and had extensive discussions with county people. I'm not certain exactly who, based upon this record, that there would be no permit required when there is a replacement for like for like. Now, that's scenarios consistent with the company's understanding of Alpine GPS who was the original lessor and had constructed an existing tower, and then apparently defaulted on the lease, and then Cellular One came in. And there are provisions in the land use ordinance, coastal zone land use ordinance, 23.08.284A1, that imply that if you're replacing like for like and it doesn't cause more obnoxious impacts, then you're able to do that for this type of communications facility. So Mr. Tynan's account of it makes sense to me. And again, it's hard to understand how it could have been different. Now, if you're not inclined to grant the continuance, there is some need to work on the conditions to make sure that there is some seamlessness to this transition. You can't just tear down one, have no service, have the emergency call boxes put in jeopardy that our clients in contract with the county to provide. And also, I mean, in a way, this is kind of a horse and cart issue. You would expect that if a project's coming before you that requires a demolition of in some a tower in this case, in which is subject to a lease, that everybody would be on board with that as to what the transitions would be and what the agreements would be. And that, I think, is important to recognize in the conditions. And I hate to come off the cuff and design projects at the at the podium, so to speak, but it is something that should be considered, how that timing occurs, because the way condition 4 is written, it wouldn't that wouldn't work. And you might also want to consider, and I don't know if that's why maybe a continuance would be in order, a condition that prior to the issuance of a construction permit for the communications facility and removal of the existing facility, the applicant shall enter into written agreements with Cellular One and Nextel to provide for uninterrupted and equivalent service levels. That way we can avoid the issues of the different competing interests, if there are any, and provide for some seamlessness and equivalency regarding the service. But again, through the company's process, we've had just this staff report. The process would be for the general manager to consult more fully with the owners and look at all of the consequences and so forth. But that's why we would ask for a continuance of this matter and to look at some of these issues, particularly regarding the seamlessness and the conditions that could be required.
Thank you, Mr. Walter. And I have Terry Reese.
Good morning. My name is Terry Reed. I began to take action. It was never a case that we tried sneaking a cell tower in place. As someone has stated, that they came in and it was federal land, and we believed with the contract that we were abiding by all the rules. Once we found out that we weren't, and I think code enforcement can show, and I have emails to back it up, the district became very proactive in trying to find a solution. We couldn't, it appears we couldn't come up with documents that show what someone has stated, which is it is a permitted tower. I still wish we could. I don't know where those documents are. Our next best process was to find a resolution with Verizon, and I believe we've done that. The district is not in a position to pay additionally for any, swaps or any part of this contract, and as Mr. Walter stated, it was something we may need to discuss. But we do have to find a solution. We do have emergency systems in play with these towers. Being that we believe that it was completely legal certified tower, we incorporated a Nextel emergency net, which handles our communications between the San Luis Obispo campus, the North County campus, and the South County Center. We found with the earthquake, that 6 point that hit up in Paso, all cell phone communications went down, landlines got blocked, and so we developed a way by getting on the police net and the fire department net through Nextel that we can communicate between our campuses, and we use that tower structure for that. Another thing that we did was we implemented it after the horrible tragedy on the East Coast. We implemented an emergency SMS or emergency notification system, which students and teachers and local residents can sign up for, and it worked through the cell system. We adopted one very much like Virginia Tech, and it works through this, so that we can put out quick messages to students in case there's an emergency. So that does go across the net also. But the most important reason for me being here was to address issues like Mr. O'Grady's and the reputation of Cuesta College. We are proud of our reputation. We try to be good partners, and I'm here to address any concern that may address that reputation or any other part of this project that I can help with.
Okay, thank you very much. So what is the desire of the commission? Should we start asking questions now, or should we just acknowledge that we're all coming back here at 1:30? It sounds to me that could be our... So I'm going to go ahead and close public comment for now. We'll come back and reopen public comment for any questions for our applicants and our speakers, and we'll continue on. I do not sense that we've got a great deal of impetus to actually continue this. We want to deal with it, don't we?
This is not the last item, is that correct?
There is one more item after this.
So we would not be able to finish by 1:30.
No.
Mr. Hogue, did you
The applicants group for the last item is scheduled to arrive at 1:30. They're flying in.
Oh, okay.
So we wouldn't want you to start that item any sooner anyway.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like your plan, Mr.
Yes.
Christensen, is the right one to me.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would add that the applicant has the opportunity to rebut.
Right. We're going to come back and reopen public,
right.
public hearing
yeah.
first thing. Okay. So with that, we will recess for now until 1:30. Thank you. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission back to order after lunch, and I want to note that Mr. Davis is here briefly for Glenn in Public Works. Glenn will be back in a few minutes. And we had just finished with public comment, but I want to go back to our public hearing because I know we have some questions from the commissioners for some of our speakers. So do we have any questions from our commissioners, or are you guys lost your train of thought?
Yeah, the train maybe is a bit off the tracks, but we'll try
okay.
to get back on. Well, I guess no particular order, but I think I asked about a berm, and maybe the applicant was going to address that.
Right. Mr. Reese has the background on that.
Okay. Yeah, we seem to have several pieces from different people, so we kind of only one applicant, but three sources of knowledge.
Good afternoon. The berm remains from the old Camp San Luis Obispo. It was a retention basin. To catch runoff, to prevent it from going down the hill. It's been there for, as long as I can remember, some 25 years.
Okay. All right. Let me find my other questions here.
Design coverage and the overall... aesthetics of the surrounding area. With the plan, it seemed to be that the monopine plan was the desired direction to go, and it seemed more aesthetic overall, and so that's why the district had, to my recollection, I mean, I wasn't completely involved in that discussion.
Okay. I was thinking there might be some advantages on the phasing of the work and minimizing downtime, and then the longevity and minimizing maintenance over time, because I understand even the best of these premium monopines, they fade after 5 to 7 years, or they lose their needles, and they need work, right? And that costs money, and I thought maybe there was more of an opportunity.
Question.
What's that?
We're still in public hearing questions.
Okay, well then, you'll have to come back up later if that's appropriate. Okay, well, that's it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. we have Mr. Walters here representing Cellular One requesting a continuance, and I didn't know if Ms. Knight would be agreeable to a continuance or if they've talked or if that would be beneficial to the applicant, to the stakeholders together.
Once again, Tricia Knight representing Verizon Wireless. We have been and we have an entire binder of documentation of meeting with the carriers that were concerned, Sprint Nextel, who is not here today and is fully aware of how the project's going forward and is going to work with their engineers to make this design work. We've been down the path. We've spent the money. We have a visual analysis that is very clear about how this design with the landscaping and the different proposed heights meets the visual segments of the general plan and the coastal area. And so I would be interested to hear under what grounds there would be for a continuance. I think the project before you is complete and cohesive. It allows for, we were talking over the break that to add some language to condition number 4 that would allow for temporary facilities to be erected for a period of 30 days or so during the construction to keep that coverage continuous so that there is no downtime. But the tower's in violation. We've been working since 2005 to get this project before you in order to help the college to correct this problem. And we feel this is the best project. We've been down many different paths, one of which you've seen. And so I guess I would just be interested to hear. We have been very forthcoming with where the project is going. We understand it's not ideal for Cellular One or for Sprint Nextel that has a facility that's already built. It's online. This tower is 90 feet tall. They're going to be losing some height in order to locate on these other two pine trees, and that is inconvenient, but it's the only design that we've been able to come up with to correct the zoning violation and also adhere to the policies.
Just to follow up, so you have been in consultation with Cellular One?
We have, an entire binder of correspondence, and we understand that Cellular One does not agree with the fact that the tower is illegal. And so I believe that they were attempting to find some documentation or figure out what happened is what we've all kind of come to the conclusion. How did this happen? Well, no one's very clear about how it happened. There's some stories here and stories there, and our recollection is from a long time ago. Bottom line being, we know what the problem is. We have known what the problem is. The college has actually had the potential for some fines from code enforcement, and we're just trying to correct the problem in the best way possible.
So you're not in favor of requesting a continuance?
That is correct.
Okay. And as far as Cellular One's request that we modify the conditions to not interrupt service,
yes,
and to maintain the same range and quality of service, would you be able to accommodate that with your mobile unit?
With respect to the same quality of service, no, because they're at 90 feet. There's absolutely no way with the proposed project that they're going to be able to maintain that. No one will be able to maintain that.
Not with the temporary service or the replacement service?
I think they only go up when they're literally a crank-up tower type situation. I think they can only go up to about 50 or 60 feet. And so that's while we're constructing the other towers. But they can't be comparable. We actually propose these monopines at a higher height. It helps everyone in the cellular industry to get as much height as they can. The visual analysis came back with these heights.
And I also believe Mr. Walter spoke to about emergency connectors with the county call boxes and so forth. Mm-hmm. Would they be able to maintain their efficiency with
It's my understanding, and maybe Mr. Walters can speak to this specifically, but if they have a temporary facility that has the same frequency and power that their current one does, they're not going to lose anything. So that's my understanding. I'll let him confirm that. But that's our goal, is to make this as painless as possible, but to also help the college correct this code enforcement.
Okay, so maybe we can ask Mr. Walter to respond to this, and because my question for Mr. Walter is, if they're not going to maintain the same range and the same quality of service because of the replacement tower,
the county would be exposed to liability under the Telecommunications Act.
You know, I understand what you just said, but it appears to me, and maybe I'm missing something here, but the intent of that act would be so you don't delay service. What we're talking, we have existing service that's actually better than what's being proposed. So I'm not sure that act would apply here.
Well, let's not make legal.
No, I'm not trying to get off track here,
but
I think it's more important to get it right. That's what I'm saying.
Well, the question of continuous we'll come back to once we've gotten through public hearing. I don't really want to get into a long debate about it right this second. What I want to make sure is we don't have any specific questions for our. During our public comment thing, and then I want to make sure our applicant has had a chance to rebut, and then I want to close public comment and come back to it.
Will we allow Mr. Walter a chance to respond?
If we have specific questions for somebody, we can always ask that question.
My question essentially was if he would like to respond to what Ms. Knight had to say, and then a more specific question for him was, will he be agreeable to the new facility as proposed, or is he trying to hang on to the
existing? He gave us a couple of specific conditions that he suggested that we use if we didn't, we're not in favor of granting continuance, so I was going to go with those, but...
But it sounds like we're not going to be able to maintain the quality or range of service that currently exists, so
but
are you...
No one's going to be able to on that tower,
right,
so...
Right.
Well, that is a real concern, obviously, in terms of maintaining the same quality, and that's very much of a concern, but something... One of the reasons we wanted the continuance was to allow for an analysis of all of that to make sure what was happening. And let me just indicate that there may be binders of stuff concerning information, but we really didn't have notice of this hearing until we were informed of it just a day or so ago. So being thrown with these conditions, it puts us in a difficult position because we'd like to fully evaluate it, know what all of the conditions are and should be, and that was the reason for the request for continuance. And it had been about 4 months since we had communications from any of the parties as to what was happening or when, and then we find out that it's happening now. But we certainly are concerned that if there is a reduction in quality, that there be an opportunity to analyze that. If there's an impact on the scope of service, that would be very important to analyze, and that was part of the reason for requesting the continuance. And again, this isn't... I think I've answered.
Okay. So, does our applicant want to make one final statement before I close public comment?
It's our position that the tower's coming down, which would mean no service. So, it's coming. If we all continue this project or it gets denied, the tower has to come down, which means that both Sprint, Nextel, and Cellular One have no service and no approved project. So, we're bringing a good solution. It's not ideal, but it is something that we believe that has been analyzed by staff and will be supported by the Coastal Commission, because this is a coastal development permit as well, which is something we had to consider. So the service that is going to be as a result of this is better than no service. And so just wanted to summarize with that.
Thank you. All right, so absent any other public comment, I'm going to bring it back to the Commission for discussion and... anything else we want to do. Do we have any real desire for continuance at this point? Commissioner Knight?
Well, my question is, Ms. Knight just made a statement that the tower is coming down. Is there a drop-dead date on that, or do we have time to allow all the stakeholders to try to absorb all this and come to an agreement how this can be done in the most prudent way? The disruption to their service.
Let's let staff answer that question for now, and then I'll say something.
Technically, the code enforcement case is closed as long as we're processing an application to resolve the unpermitted development. As far as how Cuesta College wants to handle the situation with Cellular One, that's another story. They, like Ms. Knight said, they could choose to just remove the tower per the terms of their lease agreement with Cellular One.
That help you?
So what I'm hearing you say is that per their lease agreement, they can remove it and not violate their agreement with Cellular One? They could just cancel service?
That's what I've been told by the applicant, yeah.
Well, instinctively, I'd like to give all the stakeholders an opportunity to get this right, and to accommodate them the best that we can. But I'm also hearing staff, Mr. Singhal, say that we may be in violation of that time frame, even though, without digging in too deep, I'm not sure if we're violating the intent of that timeline.
Well, the way I'm looking at it is that we have a project in front of us that proposes to address a problem, and... there have been good suggestions made about how we might change some of the conditions to accommodate...
...boxes that are being discussed are...
Can you please just state your name?
Yes. Excuse me. My name is Terry Reese. I'm with Cuesta College. The call boxes are in the direct vicinity of the tower. One is somewhere about a quarter of a mile directly to the east. The balance of the call boxes are in the center of campus. Again, one of the main reasons why we need to maintain some sort of tower structure... But it is a fairly short distance to these call boxes, and they are maintained call boxes, so they are active.
So the proposed tower will accommodate these boxes.
That's my understanding, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. O'Grady?
Why can't the new installation go forward and be completed prior to the demolition of the existing one?
In fact, we do have proposed revised condition language that would have the same effect as that. We were proposing to require, before issuance of a construction permit, a performance bond for the removal of the existing facilities and state that the existing facilities shall be removed within 90 days of final inspection of the new facility.
Wonderful. So doesn't that eliminate the transition issue?
Right. I believe within a day or two they can transfer the antennas to the new facility, so there'd be pretty minimal interruption.
Sounds like a wonderful solution to me.
Me too. Okay, so do we want to have any discussion of any other issues, questions, motion?
Would you give me a moment to review some of my notes here, please?
I'll ask a question while I'm waiting
okay.
for you. I'm concerned, majorly concerned, about the landscaping. I agree that anything is probably better than what's there now in terms of aesthetic appearances, but I'm a little concerned about things like watering and that kind of stuff and whether or not there's a lot of maintenance required there or whether there's significant water usage. Obviously, there are clumps of trees and shrubs all through there, but there's not one on that hillside now, which leads me to believe that it wouldn't be able to be naturally maintained with rainfall. So do you know anything about the landscaping details? Or can somebody else talk to me about that?
I know that the landscaping irrigation plan provides for a temporary water tank for irrigation of the landscaping.
A temporary water tank while it gets established?
Exactly, until it's
okay.
fully established.
All right. Mr. Reese, do you want to go ahead and pop it up and give us some detail on that?
We actually do, Terry Reese, we do actually have a local water source within probably 100 yards of that area.
Okay.
So we would, if need be in construction, we could assist with getting that water to the landscaping until it gets established.
Okay. So it's not a permanent kind of thing where we're going to take 40 billion gallons of water for the next 25 years?
No. We would ask the developers to make sure that those plants, once they're established, that they don't need either maintenance or water, which
okay.
is still critical.
Okay, good. That's a great answer. Let's see here. I might have had one other question.
Do we have exact language of that condition?
Yeah, I do. I have it right here.
Okay.
Yeah. I only have one copy of it.
I don't know if the applicant has seen it.
Yeah. We'll want to discuss that when we get going here. Okay, no, my question has been answered.
Okay.
Give one to Jim.
Back to a couple of mine. I had asked about once this, as years go by and technology moves forward, these monopines in the latest facility may become obsolete. And so I wondered about if there was some sort of financial commitment to restore the site, and Mr. Singlewald replied that a site restoration bond would be used to remove the facility when it's abandoned or decommissioned. Is that condition in here somewhere?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Which one is that?
Condition number 18 on page 4-16.
4-16. Okay, so that's talking about the removal of the new site and not the site that we're removing.
That's condition. Did you get new condition?
What I just handed out is for removal of the existing site within 90 days final inspection. Condition number 18 here is removal of the proposed project after constructed if it becomes obsolete, defunct, or decommissioned.
So there's three bonds on this project.
There would be
Is
three
that
bonds,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, I was just... The life of these monopines concerns me some. I think they're going to look pretty good when they go up. But then 5 to 7 years down the road, I wonder what they will look like. And is the onus on the county to drive by every once in a while and evaluate whether they've deteriorated to the point where the county says, hey, you have to fix these, and you know, or go to the bond and do it yourself? Or is there some other agreement that maybe needs to be conditioned as to who the responsible party is and how that would be prevented from deteriorating to become an eyesore?
Right now it really works one of two ways. One way is, as you mentioned, once the site is very noticeably deteriorating, we can defer to code enforcement. It's a condition compliance issue. More often, it'll be when the carrier comes to make modifications to an existing facility, say change out the antennas for a newer technology, that's when we'll make sure that they bring the whole site up to code and, say, replace branches if necessary on a monopine.
No more from Mr. O'Grady. Anything more from Mr. White? Mr. Melskow, got anything? Well, this is one of Ann's district things, so do we have somebody who wants to make a motion?
I'll give it a shot.
Okay,
okay. Okay, I move that staff the mitigated negative
draft. Not online here. I move that we adopt the Mitigated Negative Declaration ED08-207 in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 21000, and 2, approve Development Plan / Coastal Development Permit DRC 2008-00082. Based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified as follows. There's an addition of condition number 4.
Substitution.
Oh, a substitution of condition number 4, which I think has already been entered into the record, so I don't believe I need to read it. Let's see, did we have...
I
don't recall.
I don't have any other notes.
Does staff recall another change or addition that was discussed?
Well, you, Commissioner O'Grady, did email me some suggested modifications that haven't been discussed yet. I don't know if you want to make that part of your motion or not.
In the interest of time, would you remind me what I sent to you?
You want to stop your motion for a minute?
Whatever is the right protocol, but
I can read what you sent to me.
Maybe
just which item are you referring to? What's the subject?
Well, you listed existing condition numbers and proposed modified language, and it's the subject of approved development for two of them. Condition number 1, just specify that the approval authorizes the removal of the existing facility and construction of the new facility.
Okay, I thought that one. Let's see. This approval requires the prior removal. Okay, so we don't. Okay, so we take out the word prior.
Sorry, where are we, Dan?
Okay, we're at Exhibit B on page 4-13.
Okay.
And I had initially suggested rewording paragraph 1 at the introductory language. However, conditions have changed because we're not doing a prior removal anymore.
Right.
So it could just say this approval recognizes, requires the removal of an existing, et cetera. And then it goes down to next line, communications facility, and authorizes the construction. You know, actually, I think it's okay as is, because I was wanting to get the prior and the subsequent in there. So I don't think Mr. Singlewald, that's applicable anymore?
I think condition 4 covers that for us.
Yeah, so I didn't mention that. Was there another one? I mean, you've got the premium modifines in there, right? And an existing condition?
We have equivalent language
okay.
Requiring the highest quality monopine.
Yeah, I have two conditions here I'd like to suggest to my colleagues. The first one would be a time-certain removal of the unpermitted installation shall be completed within 180 days after...
within 90 days, it has to be 90 days.
Where is that? Takes care of that one. And then the third one, the proposed monopine shall be subject to approval by county staff. The specification shall require premium monopines and shall require the shop drawings be submitted to staff for review and comments. That'll make sure that we're getting what
so
we
we're
ask
adding
for
language
in the conditions.
You suggest we add language to which condition? Do you have it handy?
3G. We're adding 3G. But these are suggestions, and I would defer to the
right.
staff if they feel like that would be helpful to add that as a condition. If not, then I will withdraw my suggestion.
Well, as I've discussed, it's very important that we get the highest quality monopine. So any additional language that would, you know, forward that goal of ours, I'm
okay.
supportive of.
Thank you. All right. Then I would like to supplement my motion with an added condition, 3G, that says proposed monopine shall be subject to approval by county staff. Specification shall require premium monopines and shall require that shop drawings be submitted to county staff for review and comments.
I'll amend my second to follow.
Thank you, Bruce.
Okay. Tightened it up a little bit more. That's okay. We're making you do Ann's work here today and your own, too. Ramona.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Melska?
Yes.
Chairperson Christian?
Yes. Thank you very much, staff, for good work, and thank you for our public input, and we'll see if we can get some better-looking facilities out there.
How often do they have to be watered?
All righty. All right, I think we have, I think that's the end of our public hearings, and now we go to commission business. I'm going to give it a moment to change over, and then that will be our last item of business today, and everybody can relax. Ramona, you want to go ahead and introduce the last item?
Okay. Study session on the AT&T San Luis Obispo to Los Angeles fiber optic project supplemental environmental impact report. AT&T/UPRR conditional use permit, county file number DRC-2008-00153, Steve McMasters, project manager.
Okay, Mr. McMasters.
Good afternoon, members of the commission. Steve McMasters, county planning. As Ramon introduced, we're going to do a little study session today with you on an EIR that is currently out for public review, but we'll be coming to your commission at the end of July for action on the project and action on the EIR. The project is the AT&T project, and there's a couple things that are a little different about this that are unusual. One, it's a fairly routine project, one that maybe you wouldn't necessarily see an EIR on prepared on normally. But number two, it actually, the project evaluating the EIR actually is the entire backbone project between San Luis Obispo and the city of Los Angeles. So the county lead agency is preparing a document that covers a four-county stretch, and the county will be certifying that EIR as lead agency. So it's something that normally your commission doesn't really see too many EIRs where we're the lead that involves that many different jurisdictions. This is actually a rerun of a project that was proposed in 2002. that the county, we did the EIR in 2002, and the county actually certified the EIR, and that project was approved by the Planning Commission on September 26, in 2002. AT&T at that time chose not to complete the project, even though they had the permits, or at least permits for portions of the route, and the permits expired, and they have now decided to come back and implement that project, and so they're requesting an approval of a revised project. Because we did an EIR back in 2002, and there are some things that have changed, we prepared a supplemental EIR, as CEQA tells us to do. We felt that was the most appropriate document. Project description. The total project is approximately 242 miles. It provides voice data and streaming video and everything else that we're sending through fiber optics at this point. And it extends from the city of San Luis Obispo to the city of Los Angeles, primarily along the Union Pacific right-of-way. It follows along in actually the railroad right-of-way, as well as some road right-of-way in various portions of the route. It's essentially the same or very similar to the 2002 project with some reduction in new construction. They're actually using existing infrastructure quite a bit more than they did were proposing in 2002. So I'm going to go over the route real quickly. It essentially starts at the San Luis Obispo Junction building, which is off of Los Osos Valley Road and Foothill, extends through kind of the southern edge of the city of San Luis Obispo to the airport area. From there, it extends at 227 in the railroad to the railroad right-of-way, and then stays on the railroad right-of-way for, I don't want to guess how many hundreds more miles, but quite a ways, I think, down actually into Ventura County. And from there, it extends into some street right-of-ways into Los Angeles. The different colors on there were the different sorts of builds, primarily using existing infrastructure. Okay, the differences, the project is placing fiber in existing and vacant conduit for about 238 miles of the 242 route, so there's very little new construction. In 2002, almost the entire route in San Luis County was new construction. They were actually putting in new conduit. Access would be through existing manholes and vaults. There's about 25 miles of it would be using what's called the override method, and that is a definite change from the previous project, and that has some additional characteristics that are for the county we're going to be permitting, and then the construction and installation of new conduit is reduced from the original project from 64 miles down to just under 4 miles. This just gives us a summary of the route lengths. This is in the EIR, indicating the total mileage within the different counties and the comparison between the 2002 project and the current project. Let's see. The way the EIR is set up, part of the reason we do the study session is kind of to assist, give the commission a preview before you actually certify the EIR on how the EIR is structured. The EIR is structured in segments, and we try to tie those segments to jurisdictions. In part, we did that to assist the jurisdictions. That way, if you're the city of San Luis Obispo, you could pull up route SLO2, which is entirely within the city, see exactly where the project is going, what issues have been identified, and what mitigations are being recommended, and deciding whether if you want to implement those. So the different jurisdictions in San Luis Obispo County include the county of San Luis Obispo, the city of San Luis Obispo, and the cities of Pismo Beach and Grover Beach, as well as some activity within Caltrans right-of-way. So each of those jurisdictions will be issuing their own either discretionary permit or an encroachment permit. And the total distance is about 27 miles within the county of San Luis Obispo. In Santa Barbara County, County of Santa Barbara, the cities of Guadalupe, Santa Maria, Lompoc, Goleta, Santa Barbara, and Carpinteria. One of the more extensive new features is activity on Vandenberg Air Force Base. So they will be doing some sort of action regarding permitting the project, and the project totals about 116 miles in Santa Barbara County. For Ventura County, again, the County of Ventura and a number of cities, including Ventura, Oxnard, Moore Park, and Simi Valley, would be taking action, and their segment would total approximately 66 miles. And then the final stretch into Los Angeles, and that's primarily the City of Los Angeles and the City of Burbank, and their total is about just under 34 miles. So as you can see, there's a lot of different jurisdictions that will be, for varying degrees, will be using the EIR that the county has prepared and that the county will certify. For new build portions, which I don't actually believe there's any that we will be permitting, involves installation of conduit, installation of manholes and access vaults, some markers, and then obviously pulling the fiber optic cable into that new conduit. The override procedure that I mentioned before is really replaced in San Luis County what was going to be all new construction. They've proposed to you this override procedure, and very simply it involves pulling another fiber optic cable in a conduit that already has cable in it. There are some complexities with that, one being that they need shorter access, so rather than going from manhole to manhole, they need to access the conduit at intermediate points between manholes. So for the override segment, which is, like I said, primarily in San Luis County, including the stretch along Price Canyon and through South County, they will need to be accessing the route and digging up the conduit at intermediate points between the manholes in order to pull the cable through. In addition, in areas where the conduit may be damaged, maybe it's crimped, maybe it's slightly crushed, and they cannot actually move the new cable through, then those would be accessed and potentially replaced, or new conduit placed in those areas. As we understand it, however, they don't really know where those locations are. And so from the perspective of evaluating the project, we really had to evaluate that they would be digging it up at any point along that route. Now, lucky for us, in 2002, that's what they proposed to do. So we actually had that analysis. And the permit that we are that we'll be bringing to your commission would allow them to access the route and dig up in those locations and then implement the mitigation as necessary. Makes it a little bit interesting when I'm trying to write right now the proposed area disturbance, and I really don't know what that will be, because that will depend a lot on how successful they are with the override procedure. So it's a little bit of an unusual one, because some figures we don't have exact figures for yet.
We have a quick question here.
Sure.
While we're on this topic of the override procedure, seems to me there's a risk of with this procedure of damaging cables that are already installed, and I understand that this procedure deals with deficiencies in the raceway system, but it doesn't seem to address what happens if there's damage to other cables. Is that addressed in the EIR, or what happens in that event?
I don't think that's addressed in the EIR as far as damaging the existing system. I would actually, AT&T has their engineers here, and I think that's an excellent question for them. So for using existing conduit, really all that would be installed as far as new development or new infrastructure would be installing the fiber optic cable and putting up marker posts where there are not existing marker posts already. So it's fairly benign. This is just a couple of pictures and a list of the different types of methods to give you an idea of what this actually involves as far as the installation. They are going to use directional boring for a couple locations. San Luis Obispo County has a lot of fiber optic cable infrastructure. We are one of the hubs on the West Coast, so we're pretty used to this activity. And there's been a lot of directional boring done in the past for installing new infrastructure. For the proposed project that we evaluated in the EIR, there's a couple locations that they're proposing to do boring, and that is at San Antonio Creek, which is actually on Vandenberg Air Force Base. That's going to be a fairly long bore, and that was probably one of the most, I would say, most important issue or areas addressed in the EIR, because it is one that does have the most potential for impacts. And then in the Pismo Lake area, they will be actually doing some new installing some new conduit through directional boring. They also use the method of jacking and boring, trenching if needed, and then, as we mentioned, the override, which really from the surface looks very much like installing or pulling new cable in a conduit. As I mentioned, one of the primary issues or portions of the project that was discussed in the supplemental EIR was the San Antonio Creek bore. This is just a couple pictures, an aerial of the extent of that creek, and then it also shows you where the railroad trestle crosses the creek. So essentially they're going to be spanning that by using a directional bore by going under the creek in that location. My understanding is that's in part driven by the fact that I believe the railroad is going to be replacing this trestle in the not-too-distant future and does not want any more infrastructure festooned across it. In Pismo Lake, they're also going to be using the directional bore. I think that's in part to avoid damage to the surrounding riparian resources. We have proposed a mitigation to make them put up duck crossing signs there. As you can see in the picture, we happen to catch them going across. Actually, we haven't, but so that is another area where they will be doing directional boring activity. The EIR is really structured in three volumes, and it's meant to be tiered on the 2002 document. When you deal with a supplemental EIR, you are into the tiering mode that CEQA allows. Means we don't need to repeat anything that hasn't changed from a previous document. We're using the existing information as much as we can. So the EIR itself is in three volumes. Volume 1, which was distributed, is the summary supplemental EIR. And that's meant to be a useful kind of summary document. Volume 2 is the actual supplemental EIR, and then Volume 3 is the 2002 EIR. In the supplemental EIR, you can see the list of the sections. They're pretty much the typical sections in CEQA that requires. In the resource areas, we have structured it under each resource to go through the setting by county and by route segments. It can be laborious. It was laborious to read, because I did read it, but it was really meant so that the individual jurisdictions could find the portion that applies to them quickly rather than having to read the entire thing and then, you know, guess. Again, the rest of it is pretty much organized per normal with regulatory setting and the thresholds and the impact assessment. It covers the full range of issues, including air quality, which in this time includes a greenhouse gas analysis, which was one of the reasons to do the supplemental EIR. That was not a requirement in 2002. It has been added as a requirement for CEQA, so we felt it had to be included in this volume. And then just for if you are reading through this and you see our wonderful use of acronyms, the abbreviations are really meant for resource and for segments. So BR in this case would be biological resources, PW is project-wide, means it applies to anywhere along the project, and then impact or mitigation measure numbered. There are certain segments that is the only place where a certain impact has been identified or a mitigation measure, and thus you would see the acronym below where, for instance, cultural resources, Santa Barbara mitigation measure. So again, it only applies then just to a certain location or segment of the route. Again, just the rest of the EIR outlines, which are the usual for EIRs. And then the EIR also includes the appendices, which has all these. We actually went out with two NOPs for this project because one of the segments changed partway after we had done the original one. So we reissued a revised notice of preparation for a segment in Ventura that had changed. And all the color maps and routes are available through the website, including being able to go through using, I believe, Google Earth, so you can see the route in detail if you want. Volume 3 of the supplemental EIR is the original 2002 EIR. We need to have that available in order to tier on it. And it includes some plans which are still applicable, including the directional boring contingency plan. The summary supplemental EIR, which is what was distributed to the commission, includes a CD that has both the supplemental and the other EIR. If you really wanted to delve into it, it's all there. The summary is required by CEQA. And then, again, that one is structured, as I mentioned, to assist the jurisdictions. And we tried to use tables as much as possible by indicating where the different subsegments on the top and on the side, the impacts and the mitigation measures that are applicable to those. So we tried to use the matrix as much as we could. With a project this long, with that many subsegments, we were going to get redundant very, very quickly unless we tried to be a little more expeditious. As I mentioned, the EIR is in draft stage at this point. The public comment period extends until a week from today, I do believe. This project, one of the reasons we're here now during the draft period, which normally we don't do, and why we're doing, one of the reasons we're doing the study session is to really help expedite the hearing, which is scheduled for July 29th. The project has a few hurdles to go through, and the Planning Commission's role in this will be to certify the EIR for the entire project for use in all jurisdictions. The Commission will be making findings regarding impacts, actually, once again, for the entire project. And then the Commission will take action on the conditional use permit, which will just cover the portion in the county that is within our jurisdiction. The reason I'm bringing this up is because last time in 2002, some commissioners were a little uncomfortable making findings for impacts and mitigations that were going to be occurring far outside the county's jurisdiction. And it is unusual. We are not often lead agency for this extensive of a project, so part of this is to familiarize the commission with that role, and so you're not surprised when you get to the actual hearing. As I mentioned, they've got a number of steps to go through. This project has been identified. It is part of the internet communications backbone project that the federal government and the state government have both indicated are considered of top importance for economic recovery. And so there has been state and federal action that has advised and encouraged local jurisdictions to expedite the processing of these as much as possible. And so we have tried to accommodate AT&T's schedule. They do have it scheduled for construction for this summer. And it is a very aggressive schedule. The county, as the lead agency in certifying the EIR, will allow some of the other agencies to go forward, and this is just a list of some of their actions that need to be take place. And of critical time-wise is the bore on Vandenberg, which, while I don't think it's, I know the agencies haven't taken action yet, AT&T figures they will have a seasonal restriction of having that done by October 15th, before the beginning of the rainy season. So, they're in a hurry. We are trying to accommodate that as much as we can within the law. But it also is a project that is a fairly important one as far as for a big picture perspective.
Question?
Certainly. That was my last slide.
Oh, right.
So that's perfect timing.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Are you finished?
I'm finished. I will say that I just want to say that Mary Rentz with SWCA is here also. They were the ones who prepared both EIRs. And then we do have representatives from AT&T's engineers and environmental consultants as well to answer any of the technical questions.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. McMaster. It's very enlightening. As I understand it, we do have an actual public hearing scheduled for this item for the consideration of the county CUP, conditional use permit, and the certification of the EIR on July 29th.
That's correct.
Scheduled. My only question right now, because then I'll let the other commissioners answer their, ask their technical questions, is just out of curiosity, how is it that this county, maybe you explained this earlier and I missed it, but how is it that this county becomes a lead agency and given this extended role? Is it because it starts here, or?
It's actually...
Why do you get the joy?
Well,
we needed the work, I mean, you know.
when you look at CEQA, when you have a project that extends over multiple jurisdictions, number one, quite often these telecommunications projects, the California Public Utilities Commission would often be the lead agency. They oversee a lot of these. Now, my understanding, and AT&T's attorney isn't here to explain it all, but there's a unique relationship between AT&T and the CPUC having to do with when the CPUC came into existence and how much jurisdiction they have over AT&T. And so this is about the fourth one where we have worked with AT&T as the lead agency. Once again, the county is a hub, so a lot of their projects have components in the county of San Luis Obispo. In this case, the almost the entire segment in the unincorporated area is subject to a CUP. It's subject to a discretionary act. For the other counties, a good portion of those are going to be ministerial. They really just involve an encroachment permit. So when we sat down and met with AT&T on the initial project, the county of San Luis Obispo had the largest discretionary permit portion of the project. And in CEQA, that's one of the tests. Which jurisdiction has the biggest permit, or which jurisdiction has to act first in order for a project to go forward? And we had the biggest permit, so we got to be the lead agency.
Okay. Yeah, I thought maybe just because it started here, I thought, why not Ventura and go north? But anyway, okay. That's all. I just had a little initial curiosity. Do we have questions from our commissioners?
Yes.
Okay, Commissioner O'Grady, you're first up on my little mic.
Okay, so we're the SLO County's the lead agency, and we on the 29th we're going to be reviewing all aspects of the EIR, even those portions of the work that are in other counties. So will other counties be all their corresponding agencies also be looking at this and certifying it?
Commissioner O'Grady, the county's lead agency is the only one that certifies the EIR. One entity will certify it. The other jurisdictions, as they have discretionary acts, will use that document as responsible agencies. And they will make their own findings as necessary, depending on their role. Some of the agencies may be single-issue agencies, such as Fish and Game, where they're really only going to be issuing maybe a permit for a couple portions of the project that involve stream crossings, and obviously they're really going to only be incorporating mitigations related to biological resources, and so they may be making limited findings for their portions of the project.
What happens in the event of conflicts between their findings or their conditions and our findings and our conditions? How does that get sorted out?
It's actually not that common. I mean, part of the reason of doing an EIR is it's a public document. I mean, we sent those jurisdictions a notice of preparation to say, you know, what is going to be your role in this, what kind of permit, and tell us what you think is important and needs to be evaluated. The EIR was circulated. I will say the county requested and was granted a shortened review period for this project, in part because of its time frame and the request to expedite the process by the state and the federal governments, but also because it was substantially the same, especially in the three southern counties south of San Luis. It was substantially the same as what was permitted in 2002, and so it was really a rerun. But that is the responsible agency's opportunity to comment on the mitigations that we have proposed and recommended in the EIR. Hopefully, by the time you get to the point of action, they're in agreement with them, because that's their opportunity to recommend. To date, we have not received many comments. We didn't really get that many in 2002. I don't really expect them in this case. And then they will implement those mitigations. And I will say, the other jurisdictions have the ability to add conditions beyond what's in the EIR if based on their own ordinances or their own guidelines as far as doing work within public right-of-ways. They can add their own conditions. We're giving them the recommended mitigation measures to address the issues identified in their jurisdiction, but it'll be up to them to actually implement those.
Okay. As a first-year commissioner, not having been through this process, and there's a July 29th hearing, does the commission add conditions in connection with its actions, or what are our options on the 29th?
On the 29th, once again, I had the one slide that the commission will be requesting that the commission certify the entire EIR and make findings regarding the impacts for the entire project. Now, those findings, CEQA has certain requirements, and I think almost entirely most of you have seen findings where it's stating that the county is incorporating or adopting measures to reduce or mitigate impacts. There's another finding that you can make that you will see in this one, and that is that for a lot of them, you'll make that finding, and then we're also going to be making a finding that says that essentially changes or mitigations for portions of the project are outside of your jurisdiction and are the responsibility of the agency or the jurisdiction for those areas. That's what we did in 2002, and that's what we've done on projects, for instance, some of the fiber optic ones that had an offshore component where we were not permitting the portion out in the ocean. That was up to the Coast Commission of State Lands. And so CEQA has specific language in the findings for that case, anticipating there are times when you're going to be certifying the document, making findings, but you cannot adopt those measures for a portion of the project in Vandenberg Air Force Base. That will be up to the permitting entity for that segment. And they will be making corresponding findings when they take action in their permit.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. White?
No, I think you covered. My initial question was the same as yours, but that's comforting to hear the last comments, because that was my next question: is are we creating any liability for San Luis Obispo County? But it sounds like that finding helps relieve us of that liability. So,
Commissioner Melska?
Well,
all right. Well, I don't have any questions either. Do we just basically receive and file this? Do we have to make a motion? Jim?
No, it's just a study session.
Yeah, so. Okay. So we don't have any technical questions, guys, but, not now.
I think I asked a question earlier about damage to existing cables and how that's...
Okay, we do have a technical question.
Got a good PR person on staff.
I was going to remind you of that.
A cable hospital, I don't know.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Mike Forkert. I'm with Forkert Engineering. We're the engineering consultants for AT&T on this project. I have to mention that in 2000, we came to the SLO County, and we were very fortunate to have Steve McMasters as our project manager for a very aggressive project that AT&T was undertaking at the time in the late 90s, where we built a project from Bakersfield to San Luis Obispo. Also, Mary Rentz was involved in that. We had created a great relationship, I think a great working relationship with the county, also with Mary. And just like to thank them, thank God that they're here for this project, because it sure made it a lot easier. They really streamlined a lot of our processes we had to go through. The question, this is an override sock.
Uh-oh, the engineers start to salivate.
Overriding cable is very common in telecommunications, because, obviously, as technology has changed over the years, the old copper lines and even the older fiber optic cables need to be replaced, and a lot of times there's no new conduit, and they don't want to spend the money to put in new conduit systems. And they have to develop these products that are used very widely now all across the United States. This is a Maxell system. It's a fibrous technology. It's got silicone in it. They pull that sock in the conduit where the other facility is existing, creates holes, and then this is the fiber optic that we're going to pull into that sock.
So you're pretty well. It's a safe assumption that if that guy pulls through okay and provides these multiple paths
for
these.
The biggest challenge is to keep the product from winding around the existing table.
Uh-huh.
So this stock has the ability to slide through and create that additional opening. It comes in multiple configurations. This one is a three stock type. It does go down to one. And the rope is in it, so once
this could have solved a lot of problems for me in my engineering career. And covered up some of my mistakes. That's what it would have done.
Have been used even on this route. This route is a railroad system was plow railed in the early 90s by the railroad. AT&T is in the railroad currently with their existing cable, along with other carriers, MCI and Sprint and Quest. So one of the other carriers has performed the same function on their system, and they've done it successfully. So being that it's done across the United States and they're proposing to do it now, we feel real confident we can get it done. But you're right, there is a risk. There's no doubt about it. So you have to get the right kind of contractors, people that are experienced doing this, and AT&T will have a high presence there, make sure that if it does take their system down, they can put it back together.
Yeah, perhaps there'd be some emergency communications facilities in there, that it's a real crisis if they get interrupted.
Well, we're going to have pretty heavy surveillance. Our environmental consultant will have the monitoring crews out there with all of the contractors. Our company will have compliance inspectors to make sure that they build the system per the specifications. And AT&T, which is when Steve mentioned this is a hub, as you guys realize that a lot of ocean cables come into the San Luis Obispo County down at Los Osos Beach. So this is an extension of that cable system, and the existing cable that's in San Luis Obispo, Los Angeles right now is maxed out. So obviously this system is one of their highest priority legs to get the system in from Los Angeles to San Luis Obispo, because they're starting to run out of their capacity. So they understood that going into it, that this was going to be a 2-year permitting process. So we're coming up on, 18 months, Steve, since we started. So they're really anxious to get this done this year, hopefully. Thank you.
You know, I really appreciated what you had to say in complimenting staff about the streamlining of your project. So often what we hear, sometimes justified, but often not, is that, government can be more obstructionist than streamlining. I'd love for you to take out an ad in the paper and just repeat what you said here today.
Well,
but
I meant it too, because they really do a good job. Did I do okay?
So thank you.
All right, thanks for remembering that technical question. I'd forgotten to write that down, Steve. I appreciate it. The good news is that, maybe it's bad news. Our chair and Wyatt will also be gone for the July 29th meeting, so I'll be chairing again, so we have the same people doing the same thing, and we won't have to bring Ann up to speed about why we're making rules for Ventura County. That part is a little confusing. Okay, so I don't think we have any more to deal with on this item.
How about the July 1st?
I'm not going to be chairing July 1st.
Oh.
Yeah, Ann will be back for that one.
Okay.
She's taking long vacations, but not for the first part of the month. So do we need to have a motion to receive and accept all materials received today into the public record?
Yes.
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner O'Grady, seconded by by Mr. Melskow. And then we adjourn to our next regular meeting on July 1st?
Yes.
That's done. We're finished.
Good job, boss.